show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Minute past the hour, this Thorn in the Side Thursday is underway here on the first day of August 2013. This is the Horn, headonradionetwork.com, available at with the Listen Live button at that stream. Of course, that tends to work only with Windows Media Player type things. You can get the other stream for other streaming devices. You can listen on your smartphones via TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio. There's all kinds of other platforms that are carrying the program. People listening all over the country via all kinds. See, that's what happens when media becomes More on that later. When media become decentralized. The podcast address is at the subdomain for this program at whiterosesociety.org. And you can always go to iTunes for the podcast. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Like I said, it is Thorn in the Side Thursday, and
yeah, I got a couple that are making me a little kind of, ow, damn.
Yeah, like that. Let's see, a note on fundraising. We ended the month of July in the hole, but thank you very kindly to Randy and Janie, who got August off. Between the two of them, they took care of today's fundraising. Now all we got to do is catch up with about 3 days more, and we're golden. Okay, let's put it this way. I got a note here from Kate. I will let Kate handle this because she says it ever so much better. To the Horn family. Well, here we are at another crisis point. The first of the month, and the bills from last month aren't paid. I fear that in a day or two, we will see another notice on the homepage, closed for lack of interest, loss of internet. Thank you, Bob, for the moving anecdote about Larry Gibson, dead, with a weed eater in his hands, because his adoring friends wouldn't come and help keep his place cleared off. A cautionary tale indeed. I hope folks heard that and are waiting until the first of the month to pile on and pay the July accounts for electric, German water fees, internet, phones, and utilities for the studio. As all your effort and energy are going into sweating over the hot mic, attempting to keep the noxious weeds from devouring we, the people. I have this vision, Kate says, of the mic dangling cold by frayed wires because folks were waiting for someone else to come in and take over the weed eater. Thank you, Kate. To be honest, that was not entirely the point of my story about Larry Gibson dropping dead with a weed eater in his hands. It actually had more to do with the fact that there are a lot of people out there, you know, great big organizations with great big piles of money that are willing to let so-called grassroots activists die with a weed eater in their hands. But it's also somewhat it's applicable here too, Kate, and, you know, that's the thing. You say things and you never know exactly what they're going to mean to different people, and that's what Kate picked up on. So, yes, thank you. If we can, now that with August the 1st taken care of, if we could bring in about $450, we'd have July cleared and we could move in good clear conscience into the rest of August, which I hope will be a fairly regular broadcast schedule, vile weather, internet dropouts, and so forth, notwithstanding. But yeah, the bills are pressing. And, they just are. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com and the traditional mail address, is there also. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. And a reminder, no checks or money orders to Bob Kincaid, as I do not see that money. It goes straight to the people who get paid. So, thank you, Kate. Thank you very much. As I said, it is Thorn in the Side Thursday, and I want to start with some rather light fare that maybe not. Maybe it's light, maybe it's not. As I've mentioned, I read a lot of different news sources on any given day, and sometimes I read not necessarily with an eye toward what's going to make it onto the show, but what will simply make me a more informed human being, because trying to be informed is at least a small part of the job description here, at least as I understand it. So I'm wandering around the New York Times front page this morning, and I see a story about the ancient past of Damascus, Syria. And I don't know, it's like ringing the bell in front of Pavlov's dogs. I run right to it. I got to read it. It was a very well-written story. It was a very well-written piece of journalism about the present of Damascus, Syria, and this one very, very famous ancient road called Straight Street, or Straight Road. Those of you who, like me, were dipped by the heel in religion at an early age will know that straight is the way, or straight is the road and narrow is the way. We tend to think that that was somehow metaphoric, but in point of fact, anybody in the ancient world reading something like that would have said to themselves, oh yeah, the Market Street in Damascus, the straight one. Because see, in those ancient Levantine and Middle Eastern cities, there wasn't straight much of anything. Everything just sort of grew up as a hodgepodge where streams used to be, or wadi this, or whatever. And urban planning had not really, really become something that people thought much about. So the fact that there was one road in Damascus, Syria, that was just ramrod straight was, well, it was sort of unusual. Hell, there weren't that many straight roads in Rome. Even the Via Sacra. It had a couple of twists and turns. But this road was straight. And so it was a nice journalistic piece what was her name? Oh, well. Well, let me see if I can remember now. Hold on. Sense. There we go. Okay. Or not. Well, anyway, it got sent. But the writer, down into the... It was a fascinating story talking about who thinks who's to blame in the ongoing Syrian madness and misery, with Christians and Muslims, oddly enough, not so much at each other's throats, but both of them, both groups equally disgusted with the status of things. The story centered around the funeral of a Christian man who was planning on getting married, but wound up getting dead instead because of the civil war, and how his funeral procession made its way down Straight Street. And along the way, by way of giving a description of it, the author, the journalist writing the story, said that there were Arab shops, Muslim shops, Christian shops, a mosque here, an ancient church there, and then there was the line about, and rows of columns from the Roman Empire testifying to the fact that the city had been occupied for millenniums. M-I-L-L-E-N-N-I-U-M-S. Are there two N's in that? I don't know. Millenniums. And of course, anybody who ever got out of the first semester of first year Latin knows that the plural of millennium is millennia. That's just how it is with neuter Latin nouns. first declension singular, nominative, nominative case, first declension singular, Agricola, farmer, two farmers, first declension, nominative, plural, Agricolae. Second declension ends in U.S. in the nominative singular. It ends in I in the nominative plural. And if it's neuter, it ends in U.M. This is how you learn this stuff. It ends in U.M. in the singular nominative, and in the nominative plural, it ends in A. So, for instance, when I said earlier, in by way of introduction to the program, media has, and media have. That's because the singular of media is medium. In other words, television is a medium, radio is a medium, print journalism is a medium, but taken all together, they are media. Because medium is not an English word. Now, maybe I'll get some pushback on this. That's okay. Maybe I'm just being a language nerd. But I had, in my pointy little head, it was like fingernails across a chalkboard for me. Millenniums? I thought that was maybe the one we could expect folks wouldn't get wrong. And by folks, I mean the New York Times. But no, they did. Ann Barnard was the journalist who wrote the article. And I shot off, maybe I hadn't had enough decaf by then, but I shot off a little note to her just asking, why millenniums and not millennia? And she said, well, I know that millennia is grammatically correct. And that's how I filed my story. But for some reason, the New York Times style manual changed it to millenniums. I think I would have preferred it if that had just been a one-off screw-up. But no, the style manual says that we are going to dumb the language down even further than it already has been. Whether we like to recognize it or not, most Americans read not much higher than a sixth grade level. And when the New York Times declares, by virtue of its style manual, which is paid attention to by no small amount of people, that it will no longer be millennium millennia, that it will be, in fact, millennium millenniums, thereby making an English word out of a word that isn't English, well, something's wrong. You know, the fact of the matter is, in one of those films that we cite frequently on this program, the narrator of Mike Judge's Idiocracy says, the English language had deteriorated into a hybrid of hillbilly, valley girl, inner city slang, and a series of grunts. Of all the organizations out there that I might have expected to contribute to that degradation of the language down to hillbilly, valley girl, inner city slang, and a series of grunts, honest to God, the New York Times was not one of my principal on my principal list of principal offenders. But there they were. Millenniums. Thank you, Betsy. Betsy says, I applaud language nerds in any language. And I'm by no means an expert. I routinely butcher the language, sometimes intentionally, and sometimes entirely by mistake. But I had all, I don't know, it's, the New York Times, they're supposed to get this stuff right. And wordsmith types on the upper upper rungs or in the more rarefied portions of the atmosphere make decisions like this sometimes sensibly. For instance, one of my favorites, I actually asked a journalist that I know one time, why is it that you people, only I didn't say you people, why is it that every time I read a story about a person being acquitted in a civil trial, I read that they were found innocent? Because to anybody who's ever had a cup of coffee in law school, that's, what? That's like that moment when you reach in the fridge and, being a heathen, you take a swig of milk out of the jug only to find that it's been clabbered for about 8 days. You, puh, puh, puh. Because it is impossible in the United States of America, and in a whole lot of other jurisdictions too for that matter, for a criminally charged defendant to be found innocent. Probably because of the overtones of the word itself. Ain't none of us innocent. For we are all sinners in the eyes of the Lord. Oh, that's last night. Sorry. And so I wrote and I asked and I said, why is it? I mean, this is a glaring error. Literally, a kid, a young person who had been in law school for maybe 2.5 days could tell you that no one is ever found innocent in a criminal trial. The best a person charged with a crime can hope for is to be found not guilty. At one time, somebody told me maybe Scotland, there's a possibility of guilty, not guilty, and innocent. But not in the United States, and not in any state of the United States. And you know what the answer was? We know that. But, you see, we are the media, and as journalists, we have an obligation to get stuff right, and it would be too easy for a journalist to make the mistake and type guilty instead of not guilty, so and thereby perhaps create a libel situation. So instead, we make it very clear between guilty and innocent, even though that is factually incorrect. We're trying to cover our tushies. We don't want to get sued by somebody who got acquitted and we had a screw up down in the copy room and it came out guilty instead of not guilty. While I think that, that still rubs me the wrong way, in other words, journalists cannot be trusted to get a basic fact of a given story correct, and copy editing and proofreading are apparently out of the barn and long gone, the barn's burning, I at least understand that. And if you apply the same reasoning, at this point I'm strictly speculating, I guess the same thing applies to millenniums. If the readership of the New York Times on its best day is reading somewhere between 6th and 8th grade level, and if we assume that the liberal arts are in steep decline in the educational edifices of the United States, then it's probably just a bridge too far to ask the American people to know that a Latin neuter singular noun that ends in UM ends in A when it's a plural. But the problem is, one of consistency. So if we're going to have mediums, if we're going to have millenniums, we have to have mediums. Because neither of them are English words, and both of them are Latin words, and they both get pluralized the same way. So given the fact that the New York Times style manual says millenniums, which I should note, really does. It sounds to me It sounds to me like a seventh grade jazz band playing nothing but clams.
Hank.
It's like that. It's like the Bugs Bunny cartoon where Yosemite Sam had wired the one key on the piano to for when Bugs came to play those endearing young chants. And he always plays da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da. And the damn dynamite won't go off. And it irritates Yosemite Sam so bad. No, you darn fool rabbit! Da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-da. Bam! It may be Thorazine dart in the neck time for me. I don't know. But there's a we've got to have some consistency here. And by that I mean, if we're going to have millenniums, we've got to have mediums. Which means that at some point in time, the media critic at the New York Times is probably going to have a full-on purple polka-dotted, blue-striped, screaming conniption because his column is going to be changed from being on media to on mediums. And since we're dumbing down the language, we'll go ahead and call the business section bidness. And we can call the life section WTF question mark exclamation point question mark exclamation point. But the problem with the on mediums column is that we're not really sure if it's going to be a critique of radio, television, and print journalism, or whether it's going to be a wrap-up of the daily predictions of crystal ball readers, Ouija board soothsayers, and the shapes goat entrails get into on mediums. So that's just the kind of stuff that gets under my skin on any... Sorry, but it's Thorn in the Side Thursday, and that one really hurts. Okay, thank you, Jan. Jan writing from the UK in Scotland, you are guilty, not guilty, or it is not proven. So, you're not even innocent in Scotland. As a Scot, I can ask, have we ever been innocent of anything? Oh, don't you know I'm well past Kieran. So there's that. And I'd be interested in your thoughts. Does language matter anymore? Or is it okay? I mean, and again, I'm not one of those guys who's gonna get all prickly over the language and like you know l'Académie Française does, and insist that we put le in front of Big Mac, or that we change quarter pounder to Royal avec fromage. No. But do we have to hasten that day in which this language, this incredibly rich language, and it's rich because 70% of it comes from Latin, and it's rich because the 70% of it that comes from Latin has been translated through French, and it's rich because those French forms got overlaid on a Frisian brand of old Germanic English, and it becomes this beautiful polyglot that can just go about anywhere that you want it to take you. But do we have to hurry the day when it becomes nothing more than a hybrid of hillbilly, valley girl, inner city slang, and a series of grunts? And if you're familiar, by the way, with vocal terminologies, you know about upspeak. That's where someone speaks and the end of every declarative sentence sounds like a question. Sounds like a question? So, I went to the mall, and I got a Slurpee. And then there's vocal fry. The English language really is becoming a series of grunts. If you listen to the Kardashians, whom I don't, you will hear vocal fry, and vocal fry is crawling all over the language. And apparently, young women are using it more than anybody else. And it somehow declares disdain or just ennui. See, English. And yet we can use ennui in English. It reminds me of what Dim Leader said some years back when he was talking to the Prime Minister of Spain, and he said, "Hey, you know what the problem with the French language is? It doesn't have a word for entrepreneur." And he was serious. The English language had become nothing more than a hybrid of hillbilly, valley girl, inner city slang, and a series of grunts. Millenniums. Because it is... Maybe somebody reads millennia in a New York Times report on Roman columns at the end of the Straight Street in Damascus and says, I wonder why that's not millenniums. And they run off to the internet tubes, which has all kinds of fun stuff on it, and they learn about the difference between a singular nominative and a plural nominative Latin neuter noun or adjective. Or maybe I'm overly optimistic. After all, George Bernard Shaw said the Americans and the English are two people separated by a common language. Right. But I just had to lay that out there. Is there anything out there similar for you that when you hear it it just gets all over, it just runs right through you like a dose of salts? Or as my hero Mr. Clemens would say, gives me the fantods. I mean, if I'm thumbing through the pages of the busted knuckle Idaho moral volcano and battle cry of freedom, and I see millenniums, I'm going to go, okay. Literacy. And chuck it away. But when I find out that the reporter for the New York Times actually knows how to use the word, but the style manual insists on being dumber, signpost on the road to the apocalypse. Somewhere out there, William Safire, who was about as right-wing as a human being can get, but was kind of, did sort of pay attention to the language, is spinning fast enough to become his own personal corpse-like super collider. So there's that, and a lot of other stuff too for this Thorn in the Side Thursday. Some funnerer than others. Let's just go ahead. Well, this is kind of a twofer. It runs from Michigan to Georgia. Now, in Midtown Atlanta, there is a university that's really on the grow. It's called Georgia State University. Did I mention Midtown Atlanta? In a newspaper article at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which I don't read that frequently anymore, but used to be a half-decent newspaper, yesterday, July the 31st, Laura Diamond authored an article that reads as follows. Fall semester won't start for several weeks, but Georgia State University has already received a handful of complaints about a new student club. F all, here we go again. The White Student Union. Freshman Patrick Sharp. If he's a freshman, he's not even in college yet, is he? Freshman Patrick Sharp, ironically named by the goddess of irony. This would be so much better if it was freshman Patrick Bellard. Said he started the White Students Club so that students of European and Euro-American descent can celebrate their shared history and culture and discuss issues that affect white people, such as immigration and affirmative action. I mentioned that this was at Georgia State because Georgia State itself is probably one of the state of Georgia's most diverse institutions of higher learning. White folks are 38% of the student body. African Americans are 35% of the student body. Asians are 12% and Latinos are 7%. Sharp, 18, enters the university with a chip on his shoulder. If we are already minorities on campus and are soon to be minorities in this country, why wouldn't we have the right to advocate for ourselves and have a club just like every other minority? Why is it when a white person says he is proud to be white, he's shunned as a racist? Hey, Bob, where's Patrick Sharp from? Glad you asked. Birmingham, Alabama. Oh, okay, he's been taking summer classes, so he's already a freshman. And during the summer session, he's been flying the campus, come to our meeting of the White Student Union. We will do the minuet and the Virginia reel. And eat Lane cake. If there's anything good to be said out of this, it is the fact that it has not received official recognition from the university. There are more than 300 university-recognized student clubs. One of them is not the White Student Union. Let us all stand and sing our national anthem way down yonder in the... Patrick Sharp of Birmingham, Alabama, says they probably won't try to get official status because that would mean having to have a faculty advisor. And really, does any member of the Georgia State faculty really want to step up and be the faculty advisor to the White Student Union? Is George Wallace going to be on their seal? Maybe John C. Calhoun. Organizations like this tend to move, Robert E. Lee. It is, of course, not Patrick Sharp's own idea. He decided he would start a branch after he saw neo-maxi Zoom Dweeby, who started one at Towson State University in Maryland. You remember him, the one who went on over to CPAC and started the foo-fraw over what an ingrate Frederick Douglass was. No, really, remember that story? Yes, that kid. So, the counter flyers are now running around Georgia State University that compare Patrick Sharp's White Student Union with Nazis and white supremacists, to wit, the Klan. on the other hand, Patrick Sharp said, well, it's a pride organization. It's a cultural organization. What we have is not hate for any other group. Whites are becoming a minority. We have a voice. We're unique people, and we have every right to make that voice heard. Well, yes, you are unique people. And just as quickly as you get done defining white, we'll find out just how much of a bigot you are. Give us a call. North to Michigan. And another institution of higher learning where I suggest, were it not for the fact that, well, you know, Michigan's one of them Yankee states, so Patrick Sharp might not exactly be feeling quite so welcome there. Hillsdale College of Lansing, Michigan is billed as a liberal, small liberal arts college. However, when I saw the story earlier today, I thought, Hillsdale College. You know what? Just around, not too far at all, around the corner from the AIC headquarters in Washington, D.C., is the Robert J. Mumbly Peg Center for the Study of the Constitution. Huh. How about that? And when I looked it up, guess what? It turns out to be a little right-wing clavern for people who think that the framers got it right with that whole needed to own some property and slaves before you could ever vote thing. You know that, right? You had to own property and slaves in the state of South Carolina to be able to vote, and you had to own property, a lot of property and a lot of slaves to be able to qualify to run for House of Representatives. Not kidding. So enter Hillsdale College President Larry Arn. Really, Arn. 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 Larry Arn, A-R-N-N. Let's go to the tape for this, shall we? Advertisement. So what we're going to find out when somebody's going to have to move. Either Patrick Sharp needs to go north or Larry Arn needs to go south. One or the other.
The debate about Common Core standards today in Lansing left some lawmakers uneasy after the president of Hillsdale College referred to minority students as dark ones during the legislative hearing. Larry Arn was discussing a letter that he received from the Department of Education about racial diversity at the college.
And they said that we violated the standards for diversity because we didn't have enough dark ones, I guess is what they meant.
The lawmakers at the subcommittee here...
Hold the phone. The dark ones, I guess what they meant. Well, what did they say? Did you forget to bring the letter with you, Lair? Is that his name, or is it Herman? No, it's Larry Arn. The dark ones, I guess that's what they meant. Aw, come on, Larry, you can do better than that. Why didn't you say blah, people? That one, dark ones. I'm thinking the Patrick Dullard, or Sharp, or whatever, aimed far too low. I'm betting he's scholarship material at Hillsdale College in Lansing, Michigan. And as our friend, and she's frequently on the Facebook, on my Facebook page, Bob Kincaid on Facebook, our friend Faith could point out, this flap over Common Core curricular standards has been absolutely invaded by the right wing and the weirdos. Did I just get all redundant? Did I repeat myself? Did I say the same thing twice? Right wingers and weirdos. The college president was speaking out against the state's adoption of Common Core standards in reading, writing, and math. He said his experience. Well, here, Larry, by all means, dig the hole deeper. Please, don't let me not be an impediment to true idiocy.
Arne that they were offended by his reference. Arne didn't seem concerned about the statement and went on to say that his college was one of the first to accept white, black, man, and woman without discrimination. Arne was one of several panelists at the subcommittee hearing to speak out against Michigan's adoption of Common Core state standards.
Against Common Core state standards. Against basic standards for math, science, and English literacy. Robert in Australia with a question regarding the white student union down to Georgia State University. Are black students excluded? Any idea? I would suggest, says Robert, that every black student at Georgia State University join it. There would be an element of proof in that, wouldn't there? Robert has a delightfully subversive spirit from time to time. Thorn in the side. Thursday. What are you going to do? Meanwhile, Steve writes in from New York, hearkening back to yesterday, and Steve and Brian Fisher of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippi, his radio broadcast in which he explained that Anthony Weiner was running for New York so he could provide deep cover for Huma Abedin, his wife, to secretly bring in the Muslim Brotherhood to take all the heat off the Muslims so that they could then destroy Western civilization. Steve says concisely, no effing wonder this country is so full of fear and gun nuttery. No wonder at all. It just gets weirder every day. By the way, also sort of backing up a little bit to a previous story, you remember Morian Monday and our lead nominee, Lorne Greene of Fox News, Radio Rwanda? And why would you, a Muslim, write a book about Jesus? Mm-hmm. Fox is upset. We have upset Radio Rwanda yet again. They got so upset this time that they had to bring on L. Brent Bozo, I think, to discuss the matter. See, it's all our fault. Your fault and mine for wondering why it is that Radio Rwanda would lack the basic intellectual skills with which to understand the fact that, you know, pretty much a Jainist could write a book about Jesus, or an animist, or a Zen master, or a Muslim, or a Jew, or a Christian, or an agnostic, or an atheist. Roll tape.
Great today.
You're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity?
Well, to be clear, I am a scholar of religions with 4 degrees, including one in the New Testament and fluency in Biblical Greek.
Let's go back to the fact that we're still waiting for someone of competence to challenge Lorne Greene. Little Joe? Hoss? on her assertion that Jesus Christ was the founder of Christianity. We'll be waiting a while.
Who has been studying the origins of Christianity for two decades, who also just happens to be a Muslim.
That question from Fox religion correspondent Lauren Green launched a series of attacks from liberal media outlets after her interview with the Muslim...
Attacks. It was an attack. Now, granted, we didn't get cited again. Never got a dinner. But that's what it was. Pointing out that this woman... Did you get that? Oh, stop it. Lauren Green is the religion correspondent for Radio Rwanda. The religion correspondent couldn't understand why a scholar with 4 degrees, umpteen languages, and reads biblical gutter Greek. Sorry, it just is. The New Testament was written in sort of gutter Greek. It's not the high-flying, highfalutin, grammatically nice Greek of, say, the Iliad and the Odyssey, or the poetry of Sappho, What Fragments Remain, or Euripides or Sophocles. No, the New Testament is written. Well, you know, we were talking just a few minutes ago about millennia, and about how Americans read at about a sixth grade level. Literacy was much narrower in the ancient world. And among the semi-barely literate, being able to scratch out some, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, etc., was a pretty high achievement, and it was apparently entirely too much to expect them to be able to write good Greek. So you wind up with this Greek called Koine, which is basically the Greek equivalent of the Greek of Homer reduced to a hybrid of hillbilly, valley girl, urban slang, and a series of grunts. Yeah, the New Testament was written in idiocracy Greek. And yet Lauren Green, religion correspondent, religion correspondent for Fox News. Oh, poor Lauren Green couldn't understand why somebody who could read biblical Greek, had a bunch of degrees, is a tenured professor in religion, would write a book about Jeebus. Back to the Fox attack blonde. I'm not sure which attack blonde this is, but my goodness gracious, she's perky.
4 degrees, including one in the New Testament and fluency in biblical Greek, who has been studying the origins of Christianity for two decades, who also just happens to be a Muslim.
That question from Fox religion correspondent Lauren Green launched a series of attacks from liberal media outlets after her interview with the Muslim author Reza.
Yeah, series of attacks. Incoming!
Aslan. Aslan's book is called Zealot, and it questions the Christian belief that Jesus was the Son of God, the very foundation of the faith. The liberal media has remained quiet on the subject matter of the book, but cannot control its outrage over that question.
Shut the up. I have not been quiet on the subject matter of the book. I guess we don't count Horn Family Commune. I hate it when I take my marching orders from Fox News. Gonna have to read the book. You know what? I like reading the book. I really will. Because I'm not gonna be nervously turning every electronic page waiting for my Kindle to melt into a jihadist lump of molten slag. Idiots. But we haven't even gotten to the stupid part yet.
Why did you write it? Brent Bozell is president of the Media Research Center, joins us now to talk about it. Brent, good to see you today.
Glory call! I've been watching L. Brent Bozo on the for-profit media since I was cutting tape at CNN. And Jesus God, that was 27 years ago. What, has this guy got a painting of a normal person in his closet somewhere that's getting old? This'll be fun. That Thorazine dart is looking more and more appealing. Anyway, back to, you know. Oh, where'd she go? Now, dang it. Hey, oh, there she is. We're about to hear from the learned scholar L. Brent Bozo. Just kind of want to beat his nose.
Hey, your reaction to the reaction to Lauren Green.
Well, I'll be the first one to stand up and applaud Lauren Green for the question that she asked. It was the exact correct question that needed to be asked.
If the question was going to be asked by a total freaking moron. But he didn't say that.
Look, this man was a Christian who converted to Islam, and she had every right to ask him, she's asking him, in fact, do you have a bias? Are you being influenced by your faith to write what you're writing?
No, she didn't write, she didn't ask that. She didn't...
He should have, first and foremost, said, yes, I am. To deny it shows the arrogance. And you saw his answer. Just the aloof arrogance. How dare she even ask that question?
The aloof arrogance of saying, I have 4 degrees, I'm a professor of religion, I can read biblical Greek, and this is my field of study, you twit! But no, because he's Muslim... He's supposed to, I don't know, grovel and say... I don't think he's, like, real devout because he didn't say peace be upon him after Jesus' name. Because, you know, the Muslims have to say peace be upon him because he was a prophet. He just wasn't the seal of the prophets, the end of the prophets. The last one. No more. The stupid is strong with this one.
Look, the fact of the matter is, the Muslim faith believes that Jesus Christ did not have a divine nature.
No human does! Oh, well.
Do not believe he was...
Actually, is being a prophet somewhat of the divine nature? Oh, I think we're into angels on pinheads now, but still.
God. Therefore, if he is going to take the attitude, well, he's just a scholar, he just happens to be Muslim, that he really didn't care about this issue so much, he's not a very good Muslim.
Well, it's...
Wait. Stop. All stop. Ding, ding! Iceberg ahead! L. Brent Bozo is now competent to declare who is and is not a good Muslim? Do we now have to refer to him as Mullah L. Brent Bozo? I mean, there's some guy that we refer to as the blind Mullah. Do we just refer to L. Brent Bozo as the dumb Mullah? The stupid Mullah? You see, of course you do, the arrogance that attaches to these privileged white people as they declare who is and is not a good and proper member. Well, you know, in L. Brent Bozo's world, Reza Aslan is probably not a good Muslim if he doesn't have 30 sticks of dynamite.
dynamite wrapped around his waist. Wah! Asshole. Sorry.
Started out with very far left media questioning Lauren, criticizing.
Very far left media. Can we take a moment to ask, what the f*** does that mean?
Texas Betsy pointing out that within a religious scope, all humans are created in God's image. We'd all have a divine nature. This is what is supposed to keep us from hurting and insulting each other. Very, very effective use of the word supposed, Betsy. Marty writing in, but Bob, you know you don't get to question the religious industrial complex. Media Research Center? Doesn't Murdoch partly fund the Media Research Center? I'll take a dart or two with you. Take a number. Back to L. Brent. And this woman who's out there defining far left media. You know why they're upset about the far left media? BuzzFeed. Yeah, BuzzFeed is the far left media now. Congratulations. Here's your laurel and hearty handshake. BuzzFeed is the far left media and labeled and you know what? I have a feeling BuzzFeed knows about a few of these, but they labeled this particular interview the most embarrassing interview Fox News has ever done. And, you know, that takes in the entire oeuvre of Bill O'Reilly and the life support system for a haircut. That's a pretty tall call. But it was pretty embarrassing. Made more delightful by the fact that it was being done by Lauren Green. I can't get the Alpo ads. Old Charlie here is 9 years old, but look what happens when we starve him for 3 days and then put some Alpo in. Yeah, come here, Charlie.
...sizing her, saying that she shouldn't have asked the question or that it was any of her business about what his prerogative may have been on writing the book. It then trickled out into more and more mainstream media, and it's taken on a life of its own, the discussion about Lauren versus the book or the author.
Sure.
Was that a question?
There we were discussing upspeak, and lo and behold, we find the Fox woman who doesn't when she should. So poor L. Brent Bozo's left there with a couple of seconds of dead air, and what's his answer? I mean, I don't know. Maybe his IFB went booger.
Mainstream media, and it's taken on a life of its own. The discussion about Lauren versus the book or the author.
Sure. Why don't they talk about the author? Why don't they talk about the fact that he makes the statement, which NPR had to correct, that nowhere in the Bible did Jesus Christ claim to be the Messiah, which is absolutely false.
It's absolutely false. And NPR had to correct it. Well, by God, we know he's no scholar. Because the folks that are brought to you by Northrop Grumman that have bombed the snot out of lots of people over there, well, they corrected it. I'm kind of familiar with this topicality. You got to get into the weeds to find Jeebus declaring himself to be the Messiah. He lets other people do that and remains silent. Oh, L. Brent Bozo, let's talk about the Trinity.
Oh, no, it says there in the book of John, in the first chapter, in the first verse, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. See, that's the Trinity!
No, it's not.
He made the claim in his book, this is the man who is such an expert on this, that the crucifixion was Jesus Christ fomenting violence in society. Apparently, he's not familiar with a thing called the Beatitudes.
Oh, Brent Bozo, Brent Bozo, Brent Bozo. He's also not... You apparently are not familiar with some of the more lunatic statements that Jesus makes along the way. See, this is the problem. Even with your liberal so-called Christians.
Well, no, Jesus loved everybody. He's like Barney the dinosaur. Loved everybody. I love you. You love me.
No, there are passages where he says, whoa, where he says he's bringing a sword. It's really there.
He also suggested in the interview with Lauren Green, he said something that I found very interesting. He said that his book was based on 1,000 books that were used to make this book. Now, Shannon, I don't know about you. I've never in my life heard an author say that 1,000 books were his reference to doing a book. And while we're at it...
I remember when Ann Coulter would go on the things like the life support system for a haircuts program, and, oh, I got lots of footnotes, Sean. You know, see a little Adam's apple bobbing there. Is it, anybody, chime in, please, help. Is it somehow impossible that an author could consult 1,000 books? Is that like the speed of light for academic research? No. You can consult $9.99, but you're going to turn into a pumpkin if you consult that thousandth book there, Dr. Aslan. God, Lauren Green's such an idiot. I'm surprised she didn't ask a question about Narnia with a last name like his. Hold on.
He also said more than once that he had a degree in a history degree in religion. In fact, he doesn't. So there are all sorts of holes you can poke in this man's very, very biased and very, very one-sided book that is aimed to do nothing but attack. He also makes the point...
Aimed to do nothing but what? Make your allegation, Mr. Bozo!
And this is something a Catholic, I take great offense to.
Wait a minute. Wait. Stop it. Back at the beginning of this clip... Was it not this goober who was carrying on about how Dr. Aslan didn't disclose his pre-existing biases? And I got to get 3 minutes and 17 seconds into the interview before we find out that L. Brent Bozo is offended because Dr. Aslan has said something that he disagrees with because of something pronounced by a 5th or 12th or 16th century pope who didn't know how to take a... Bath.
So there's a big, very big difference between a historical Christ and what the Catholic Church has done to create a mythical Christ.
That's the truth. Hell, there's a very big difference between the historical Christ, because the historical Christ does not exist. I mean, for you Jesus believers, there's no historical Christ. There's no independent confirmation of his existence. None. Zip, zilch, nada, niente. There is a hagiographical Christ. There's an offhand reference in a Roman historian talking about how a sect of religious zealots were persecuted following the great fire of Rome under the rule of Nero, who were said to be followers of Crestus, C-H-R-E-S-T-U-S, could easily have been the early manifestation of the Roman god of toothpaste. But not much more. But in point of fact, if there was a living Yeshua Bar Yusuf, then he was completely reinvented by the highly hallucinated, the deeply mentally ill Saul of Tarsus on the Lamb who changed his name to Paul. And we haven't even gotten to the Council of Nicaea yet. But it's the absolute truth. There's the Jesus of the Gospels, whose only reference to sexuality is to say that some are born eunuchs and some make eunuchs of themselves, but that it is better off if a person marry but don't get divorced. I mean, that's kind of a little composite there, but that's it. And then there's the Jesus of the Roman Catholic Church that says the queers are going to burn in hell. Yep. But L. Brent Bozo is deeply offended. Hey, you want to go start a crusade, Mr. Bozo? Go and shed some blood for Jeebus, or go and be a martyr yourself, buddy? You freak.
No, there isn't.
Well, is there a bigger question?
Okay, so you know what? That's what makes it fact on Fox. L. Brent Bozo said, no, there isn't. Without me interrupting, let's catch that entire assertion, and let's see if it could get past, oh, I don't know, freshman year philosophy 101 intro to logic.
He also suggested in the interview with Lauren Green, he said something that I found very interesting. He said that his book was based on 1,000 books that were used to make this book. Now, Shannon, I don't know about you. I've never in my life heard an author say that 1,000 books were his reference to doing a book. And while we're at it, he also said more than once that he had a degree in a history degree in religion. In fact, he doesn't. So there are all sorts of holes you can poke in this man's very, very biased and very, very one-sided book that is aimed to do nothing but attack. He also makes the point, and this is something a Catholic like I take great offense to. He said there's a big, very big difference between a historical Christ and what the Catholic Church has done to create a mythical Christ. No, there isn't.
Well, he says no, there isn't. So everybody, convert or die. All those paintings of that blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus promulgated by the church, there is no difference between that and the historical Jesus, who was probably about 5'2", had a nose that laid all the way across his face, and curly black hair. Never mind the distinct similarities between that Jesus of the church and Apollo. Shh, don't tell L. Brent Bozo. Let's not tell him that the God of the Sistine Ceiling reaching out his little nose-picking finger to a very homoerotic Adam. Let's not tell L. Brent Bozo that's imagery picked directly from ancient Greek iconography regarding Zeus. Let's don't. It's liable to have an aneurysm. In that case, let's do.
Well, is there a bigger question here about the discussion of the Muslim faith in America today, in 2013, and whether you're allowed to prod or probe? There's a lot of sensitivity across the spectrum when it comes to talking about religion, but especially the Muslim faith.
Oh, wait, all of a sudden they're all upset about somebody asking questions about their avatar, when in fact some of L. Brent Bozo's biggest buddies have made a career out of alleging that Muhammad, here, we'll go ahead and say it just to keep everybody happy, peace be upon him, was a child molester because his last marriage was to a 9-year-old. But now they're sensitive. And now they want to have a discussion about what those Muslims are doing. Ooh. Do you realize a devout Muslim would sooner gag himself than say something bad about Jesus? Because he's all over the Quran. And his mother Maryam is revered. The layers of stupidity that one must certainly have to wade through just to get through the lobby of Fox News would... Remember how Bill last night said that you can get in real trouble if the water gets up over the bibs of your hip waders and it can... Yeah, that.
And do you think that's why Lauren is taking so much heat?
Well, because you're... Look... Shannon, let's put it in this perspective. First of all, the media can't stand you folks at Fox. I mean, there's a headline you didn't know.
You folks, as if there's a difference between L. Brent Bozo, Rupert Murdoch, and Fox. I don't want to tell you where Rupert has to put his hand to make L. Brent Bozo's mouth work.
But what I find really curious, Lauren is the only, I may be wrong, and if somebody correct me if I'm wrong, I do not believe there's another religion reporter on television today. Lauren Green is the only one. In
which case, there are none.
Business Today. So who in the world is to criticize Lauren Green at Fox News?
People who aren't religion reporters but have more knowledge about religion than Lauren Green would have if she studied religion for the rest of her miserable life. That's who.
Well, we know that there are a lot of folks out there who are happy to criticize Christian viewpoints and faith, and we have a story on that coming up as well.
Oh, really? Is anybody being martyred? Anybody getting a pine torch stuck up their ass and lit on fire in the Vatican Gardens? Because, see, that's persecution.
But this
Sharon,
one...
Let me say one thing.
Oh, please.
Let me say just one more thing. I know Lauren Green. Lauren Green is...
I know Lauren Green. Lauren Green is my friend. You're no Lauren Green.
She's a good, good woman. She doesn't deserve to be attacked like this.
Notice the sexism. Lauren Green is a good woman. She's not a good person. She's not a good human. She's not a good individual. She's not a good soul. A good woman. Oh, brother. She's a good woman. She's a good woman. Stays home. Don't ask for much in the way of shoes. Weaves her own cloth. And done bore up 19 cherins. Good woman. Good woman.
Well, I often encounter her in the halls and have always found her to be a very fantastic colleague, somebody who does care about what...
Well, how about that? The female notes that she's a good colleague. Of course, if she'd said she was a good woman, the nonagenarian viewers of Fox would have been screaming that there was, lesbianism. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go off the rails like that. Or maybe I did. But Jesus, they can't even defend themselves properly. Because, frankly, Lauren Green's interview was indefensible. Wasn't it? There's a reason we call this Thorn in the Side Thursday. There certainly is. Back to the mailbag. Going back to the vocal intonations question. Kate writes in. And she asks, under the subject line, thorns, when did women start talking through their noses? That nasal noise that ends with a question makes me want to scream. I usually just reach for the volume knob. When did folks start answering a question with so? I've noticed it happening in interviews all over the radio of late. And about a decade ago, radio folks started saying, and your weather for today. Your this and your that sets my teeth on edge. I'm so glad I'm not alone in this. Or when an author is writing a scene about someone falling down in a room during a fight, and he fell to the ground. What? The floor isn't the ground. The ground is outside. Duh. God, it gets to me. Woe him to the ground, Centurion. Woof we. I make corrections in books with pencil, of course, just to let the reader know that there is a grammatical error. Back in the olden days, we didn't have the word nerd. We were the folks who got good grades. With teachers who corrected our papers with red pencil, we paid attention in class and could diagram a sentence and didn't have God in the pledge. Damn, I be old! By the way, says Kate, thanks to everyone who is contributing tonight. We can't afford to lose these language and history lessons. And thanks go out to Betsy and Jason and, well, Kate. Thank you all. Between you, Janie and Randy did, we're at $270 for the night. If we can keep it rolling this way, $295. Thanks, Ed. Thank you very much. $295. We keep this going and we might get out of July's hole. It would be awfully nice. So this is, however, Thorn in the Side Thursday, not Prayer Meeting Wednesday. I didn't mean to make this. No, that was a journalism story, just like Millennium's was a journalism story. So let's just keep this in proper perspective. But it is Conversation Radio, and the Skype line is open. Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. On the traditional telephone line, 304-658-3333 is how you reach the program. And we'll take a little break and come back with either your calls or more filibuster. I have not as yet seen this Thursday's edition of the Green News Report. C'est la vie. So light them up if you want to, the phone lines, or anything else for that matter. We're not judgmental here. This is Conversation Radio. This is, in fact, the Horn.
A long time forgotten, dreams have just fell by the way. The good life he promised ain't what she's living today.
Really?
But she never complained of the bad times or the bad things he's done, Lord. She just talks about the good times they've had and all the good times to come.
She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-timing man. She loves him in spite of his ways she don't understand. Through teardrops and laughter, they pass through this world hand in hand. A good-hearted woman, loving a good-hearted man. He likes the bright lights and nightlife and good-time friends.
And when the party's all over, she'll welcome him back home again.
Love knows she don't understand him, but she does the best that she can.
Now this a good-hearted woman, loving a good-time man.
She's a good-hearted woman in love with ups and laughter, the paths of this world hand in hand. A good-hearted woman, loving a good-timing man.
It's Thursday, August 1, 2013.
This was a beautiful beach. I'm in shock.
Meet the world's newest oil spill, now in Thailand. Fast-charging buses debut in Switzerland. Breaking wind news, plus...
But I've got to tell you, just gutting our environmental protection, that's not a jobs plan.
Obama debunks Keystone XL jobs myths, but ignores unstoppable tar sands oil spills.
You say unstoppable tar sands oil spills like it's a bad thing. All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
There isn't even one study that can be produced that shows that carbon dioxide is a harmful gas.
Michelle Bachmann, they're laughing at you, not with you. This is your Green News Report.
Let's deal in reality, not in false narratives.
Yes.
Okay, Desi Doyen, for some business, we welcome aboard our newest affiliate partner, the Philip Raquel Show. Glad to have you on board, Philip. Thank
Yay,
you.
Yay, Phil!
Indeed. Number two, I posted a very, very short video from NASA at bradblog.com today showing our global heat temperatures going back to the late 1800s when we started keeping records of such things. I challenge anyone to give that 27-second video a look and then come back and tell me how global warming is a hoax.
Oh, yeah. And it comes at a good time, by the way. Greenland just recorded its highest temperature ever on record, 78 degrees in Greenland. Plus, eastern China is now getting its worst heat wave on record.
But other than that, it's all a hoax. What do you have for us today in non-hoaxy news?
Meet the world's newest oil spill.
In Thailand, an oily beach, evacuations, and fears the black sludge could reach the mainland.
Tourists have been evacuated from a popular beach on the island of Koh Samet that is now blanketed in crude oil after an offshore pipeline rupture 12 miles off the coast dumped at least 13,000 gallons of crude. Thailand's deputy prime minister admits his country is not equipped to deal with spills, and the chairwoman of the Thai Chamber of Commerce is not happy.
I believe it took too long to contain the situation. In the long run, if you don't quickly solve this, the tourism industry will suffer.
Amazing photographs of knee-deep sludge and an army of people trying to clean up that beach. Incredible.
Speaking of messes, President Obama again debunked and ridiculed the wildly inflated jobs claims of Keystone XL pipeline supporters.
Yeah, they keep on talking about this. An oil pipeline coming down from Canada that's estimated to create about 50 permanent jobs. That's not a jobs plan.
50 permanent jobs, contrasted with what the Republicans are saying, 10, 20, 100,000 jobs. Why did it take Barack Obama so long to respond to these talking points that have been allowed to fester?
I have no idea, but I'm glad he's finally doing it. What he hasn't talked about, though, is the immediate environmental destruction of tar sands oil spills, like in northern Alberta, Canada, where thick tar sands oil has been gurgling up through the ground after underground wells failed. Canadian regulators said Wednesday that the company responsible remains unable to stop the leak, and this is a direct quote, there is no control of this incident.
This is amazing. These are the tar sands oil fields that they're going to pump through that Keystone XL pipeline.
Right, and meanwhile, 12 miles of the Kalamazoo River in Michigan have been closed this week because cleanup of a tar sands pipeline oil spill in the Kalamazoo River is now in its third year with no end in sight.
So the tar sands spill was 3 years ago, and they still don't know how to clean it up in Michigan.
That's right. Undeterred by unstoppable tar sands pipeline spills, pipeline company TransCanada announced plans this week to build another pipeline across Canada to the East Coast in response to rising opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline here in the U.S. and opposition from the government of British Columbia for a West Coast pipeline. Meanwhile, after decades of offshore lease sales to the oil and gas industry, the Obama administration this week held America's first ever offshore lease sale for wind energy. A Rhode Island company just won the right to build the first offshore wind farm in American waters off the East Coast. Finally, a very cool innovation, a new electric bus system that turns bus stops into fast charging stations and completely eliminates the need for overhead power lines. But we don't get it here in the U.S. The demonstration project is in Geneva, Switzerland. Check out the cool video at our website.
Yeah, it's really cool. The bus stops, it plugs in, 15 seconds, charged up, moves on to the next one. Awesome. Innovation. Thank you for ending on a positive note. For a change. For much more on that and the other stories we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help the Green News Report stay on your public airwaves. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Chased Lady Luck till we finally struck Bonanza. With a gun and a rope and a hat full of hope, we planted our family tree. We got a hold of a pot full of gold Bonanza. With a horse and a saddle and a ring full of cattle, how rich can a fella be? On this land we put our brand, our pride is the name. Fortune smiled the day we fired the Ponderosa claim. Here in the West we're living in the best Bonanza. If anyone fights any one of us, he's got to fight with me. Parson Joe and Adam know every rock and pine. No one works, fights, or eats like those boys of mine. Here we stand in the middle of a grand bonanza. With a gun and a rope and a hat full of hope, we planted our family tree. We got a hold of a pot full of gold bonanza. With a house full of friends with the rainbow ends, how rich can a fella be? On this land we put our brand, our pride is the name. Fortune smiled the day we filed the Ponderosa claim. Here in the West, we're living in the best bonanza. The friendliest, whitest, lovingest band that ever set foot in a promised land. And we're happier than them all. That's why we call it Bonanza. Bonanza.
Oh, come on, you can't blame me.
Bonanza. Bonanza.
Yeah, thanks, Lauren. Lauren Green. The theme from Bonanza. I bet you didn't even know it had lyrics. I kind of like that Lauren Green better than the hypocritical Islamophobic one, but, you know, who the hell am I? Well, who am I? I'm Bob Kincaid. It's 29 minutes past the hour, and our buddy Tim from L.A.'s got a Twitter bomb going out right now trying to rustle up a, see, Bonanza, Russell, get it? Trying to rustle up a little help, and thanks very much. Thanks very much to Jude and to Kate and to Ed and to Janie and to Randy and to Betsy and to Jason. We are at $395 now, and we might get close to actually putting July to bed and making it a little more likely to make a whole bunch of bill paying. Get a whole bunch of bill paying done. Oh, Jude, it does ease worries. It does. Thank you. Kate writing in, ah, those old boys. Thanks for the wailing, Willie. Hope we're done with Fox News for the week. It's entirely up to Fox News, Kate. Entirely up to Fox News. Let's go to the phones here as we reach the halfway point of tonight's Thorn in the Side Thursday. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm going to be brief tonight, Bob. I talked enough last night. But Bozell, I'll give you a little background on Bozell. I'm sure you know it, but a lot of the audience may not. I have a book buried in my library somewhere because I haven't needed to start a fire. It's called With MacArthur in Korea. And Bozell made every damn thing up in that book to make MacArthur look like Hannibal, you know, or Napoleon. And, you know, MacArthur did pull one stunt, and that was that invasion at Incheon.
Wait, he managed to actually write a book about something?
Oh, but it's a piece of trash.
Oh, okay. Birdcage liner?
Yeah.
Or do you think better of the birds?
Because, I mean, MacArthur made many mistakes. I said last night probably one of the best things he ever did was when he was Chancellor of Tokyo. Supposedly, he really, when they, you know who wrote that Japanese post-war constitution, don't you?
MacArthur.
Yeah, and the other Americans. And he did go all out. So theoretically, I've seen it in, by a few authors, that he was one who was really pushing for women to vote in Japan because he felt that that women voting might put an end to a lot of the quick fire wars that were all over the place. Mac was a funny guy. You want to real see a funny guy? Look at his father.
There were two great. Well, William Manchester, I suppose, is most known for.
Yeah, he's one of the best biographers of my Mac.
And his American Caesar is nothing if not brilliant.
Yep.
And I think there's an argument to be made that, well, MacArthur had those designs.
Yeah. Well, he wanted to be president, yeah.
No, I think he wanted to be American. He wanted to be dictator of America.
Well, it could have been, yeah. That's, a lot of those guys had that taste, yeah. You know, not that. Well, some people would tell you for FDR. But I don't know if it was FDR's real thing to be, you know. I think he got stuck in one of the biggest holes this country's ever seen, that depression, and then. You know, I hate to say this because I know it's not a peacenik, but somebody had to do something with Uncle Adolf. And you know, the guys in the Far East weren't. When you read, go read the Rape of Nanking and you'll.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
well, but you know, that's another historical aspect of it all. We turned a blind eye. And I think there's a lot of it that's racially motivated. We turned a blind eye to the horrors that were being perpetrated in mainland China.
Yes.
And the horrors of the little dust up that went on in the 30s between the Soviets and the Japanese.
Oh yeah. There was two good set twos in Mongolia in the late 30s.
And we turned a blind eye to that.
Yeah. The Russians. You know, the Japanese built some wonderful cars, but they sure couldn't build a goddamn armored vehicle to save their ass. you talk about ironic, because their cars, although me, I'm still, man, when you come to a foreign car, give me that damn Beetle, will you?
Yeah.
Fix that and I'll
Well, no, I mean, I, well, there's a lot to be said for that, and I guess it's more pollution generating, but that air-cooled engine that ran in the back of a Beetle, the souped-up version of which got dropped in those in some sporty little coupes called Porsche.
Yes, sir.
Hard to beat.
Yeah.
You know, once you had the right tools, and the right tools were critical, but, I mean, my God, the oil sump, it took I don't know if you know this or not, but in the boxer engine that went in, horizontally opposed cylinders, in the boxer engine that went in the Porsche 911, it took 11 quarts of oil to do an oil change.
Oh, yeah. They sure sucked it up, didn't they? Well, of course, the more oil. One of the first things we used to do when you bought a used car was you got rid of the idiot lights and you went with mechanical oil and.
Gauges, yes.
Yes. Because, man, I wanted to see. I put a 327 in a Nova. That was a fun car to drive, but I'll tell you. But anyway, The first thing I do is I got a mechanical argument. I want to see what the oil pressure was.
Well, and then when it comes to British automobiles, you know what the old saying was there, right, Bill?
Well, it's why they had two seats?
No, if there's no oil on the floor, there's no oil in the car.
Yeah, true. Well, there was a one joke about the two-seater sports car. The reason they had two seats, they had to have one for the mechanic. One that we heard a lot. But Bozell, as I say, I have this book. I think it's entitled With MacArthur in Korea, and it's just one piece.
Was he with... No, wait, stop. I got to ask. There is no way that L. Brent Bozell was with MacArthur in Korea.
No, of course not.
Any more than Marion Robertson was.
Yeah, but oh, that's another story. Yeah, that's one that that I learned how he got Marion got pulled off the Incheon invasion and sent back to the ship to guard the booze.
Yeah.
Now, that's the story. I hope our friend is listening, the younger fellow who was a Marine, because I've heard him mention that too.
Yeah. Liquor supply officer. Because his daddy was a senator from Virginia.
Well, the guy MacArthur put in charge of that 10th Corps, or X Corps, whatever you want to call it, the Marines, 1st Marines, 3rd Army, 7th Army, on the right-hand side of the Korean Peninsula, you know, on the east side. He goes up there, he flies up there, and he told these guys to not let a few, quote, Chinese laundrymen stand in your way.
Did he not tell them that the laundrymen had guns?
What?
Did he not tell them that the laundrymen had guns?
Well, hell, come on. Man, you know where they got a lot of their guns? They got them from Chiang Kai-shek. You know where he got them?
Yeah.
They ain't nothing like handing a Korean, an enemy in Korea, handing him a decent rifle that he got from Chiang Kai-shek. Or some of the guys up there called him Canker Jack. I love that one. Of course, as I say, we know what he was about, and China was a mess, and Mao and company, they didn't do everything right either. But I'll tell you, at least it was the reason Chiang Kai-shek lost was that nobody would much fight for him. He was beaten by people who were more intent on doing what they thought was right. But anyway, I just wanted to comment on Bozell because that was probably the worst thing. I wish somebody would send in the name of the guy that MacArthur gave command of that bunch to. He was his chief of staff for a while in Korea, and so he makes the guy a... And the guy was a Texan who got let go in Italy because of his poor handling of some black soldiers in particular, from what I've been able to gather from reading and hearing, and from Second World War history. So, it's like we said last night, Bob, it just keeps going on and on. And this guy is still, somebody's still listening to Bozell?
The nonagenarians at Fox, who watch Fox. And, I don't mean to be hard on nonagenarians or anything. I hope to be one someday. But I hope I'm not watching Fox.
Well, you know the guy who runs Fox. What's his name?
Murdoch.
No, the other guy.
Ailes?
Yeah. He was working out of Cleveland. I did two commercials for him. One was called The Signs of the Times with kids throwing rocks at schools. And the other was I played the English drinking, God Save the Queen.
Yeah.
That we set different words to. I played that on the harmonica. And they paid me $100 for 7 minutes of my time. But about 3 months later, in Newsweek, they were ripping those commercials apart because of their negativity.
Don't shoot me. I'm only the harp player.
Exactly. I'll let you go, because it's time for somebody else to get in here and say something. I had my share.
All right. Bill, you have yourself a good night.
Good weekend, man.
All right. Bye now. Hey, it's not the weekend yet. What? Did Bill just give me tomorrow night off? Wow. Hey, welcome to the program.
What's up, Bob? Hey. Jim and... Louisiana?
Yeah, how's Louisiana staying today?
Well, things are looking up. I might have some gainful employment, but we'll see what happens. But let me ask you, I kind of heard, I don't know if it was you, that wasn't you, but I heard something about Obama, and he's talking health care and SSI stuff again, and like he's going to be giving more away. Is part of like his...
No, you mean that the bargain's getting grander?
Yeah. exactly.
I read a little bit. I saw a little bit of that today, and hell, I always feel like I'm halfway down the rabbit hole or through the looking glass or what. I don't know what to make of it anymore, Jim. There seems to be an urge to do away with the social safety net that I don't understand.
I don't either. Just from a logistics point of view, the way I look at it, if you have a lot of people getting sick or can't take care of themselves, even the rich, even with their gated communities, and the fact that the sky spooks are watching out for them and taking extra good care of them, even with all that, their chances of getting sick in a disease-ridden area go up substantially. Am I kind of crazy or what?
No, I think you're there. Nothing kind. I mean, you're not kind of crazy. You're well. If that's crazy, we need more people that are.
Yeah. I mean, you ever read any Gore Vidal?
Oh God, yes, tons of it. You know what I've been looking for? I was frustrated. I went down this road last night about the difference between having a hard copy book and a book on an e-device. It is frustrating. The one thing about e-books is that there is instant gratification involved. You can have it in your hands the minute you want to read it, if they've made an e-book out of it. And I badly want to read, because I've read a bunch of his books. I've read Creation and Lincoln and Burr and a couple of others, but I had never read Julian, which I find conceptually fascinating.
You are a psychic, dude, because that's exactly what I was thinking of, because I read that.
Well, I went to say, you know, this is a well-known author. Nope, sorry, not available on for an e-reader. Thanks. Which, you know, means I either have to wait for it to come in the mail, or I got to go to a brick-and-mortar store, which means 55 miles down the mountain and 55 miles back up the mountain, in the middle of which the people at the brick-and-mortar store will say, well, we ain't got it, but we can order it for you. So can I. You know, it's frustrating.
Right. No, as I remember Julian, I haven't read it in, I don't know, 20, 30 years, but it was like a great premise, because it was like, I think the subtitle was The Last Pagan Emperor.
Yeah, and Julian the Apostate.
Yeah. And that was pretty interesting. You know, you don't read that, but also his essays were outstanding, too. I mean, I could just read his essays all day.
In fact, have you ever gone on the interweb tubes and watched a few of the beatdowns that he delivered to Norman Mailer and... who's the right winger? William F. Buckley. All I have to do is talk with my tooth clenched, and I immediately remember William F. Buckley. He just beat him like a barred mule on TV a few times.
He's a famous. I have to go. I have to check that out. That sounds interesting. And as long as it's not like book reviews, another one. I've only read a little bit of it, but it's JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the plot to assassinate John F. Kennedy by L. Fletcher Prouty. Did you ever hear about that?
Yeah.
Did you read it?
Don't think so. No. I did read the book long ago that was, what was his name? Jim. He was the DA in New Orleans.
Yeah, it was my father.
It was your father?
Yeah, Jim Garrison.
Wow! I read that.
On the Trail of the Assassin.
Yes. And that of course was what. Holy cow! I'm blown away.
I didn't know whether to tell you or not.
Oh no, that's cool. That's really cool. And you know, Oliver Stone apparently thought highly of your dad.
Yeah. Well, the introduction to this book is by O.S. and then you got a preface or a foreword by Jesse Ventura.
Wow. Well, I think. Well, tell me that. Tell me that. I mean, your father's convinced that the whole story was never told.
Oh yeah. I mean, he had no doubt that he was pretty much 99% or high 90s. You know what was going on. I mean, plus the way they infiltrated his office and stuff, and then all the, you know, and I was a young kid, and every which way. And then when he lost to Clay Shaw Tribe, he was going to try Shaw on perjury, but then the Supreme Court stepped in and said that would be double jeopardy. That doesn't, I'm not a lawyer, but that doesn't sound like double jeopardy to me. But, you know, all sorts of strange things happen. Then all the witnesses dying, or a lot of witnesses who, you know, could die. And he told me, too, that they offered him a federal judgeship just to kind of go away, but he showed the guy the door. So, kind of, I don't see the advantage for him lying to me about that. You know,
no.
No. 30, 40 years later.
No, conversations between fathers and sons tend to be pretty candid, especially later in life.
I'll tell you another interesting thing. Now, I remember this. The night Bobby Kennedy got assassinated, my dad was going somewhere, and it was like, I don't know, 6 o'clock Central Time, New Orleans, and my mother says, and it's the night of the California primary, and my mother says, Jen, do you think Bobby will win? And my dad looked, and in this very dry, matter-of-fact way, says, Bobby wins, they'll kill him. And he was even blown away that it was done the next day, that done that quick, or it just happened to happen that quick. Maybe.
Holy mackerel!
So,
I'm just gobsmacked, Jim. No,
it's like when they opened up the investigations in '78 under Carter, the presidential. He kind of talked to him a little bit, but they didn't really want the truth. They just kind of wanted the plan. And even then they came out, well, okay, there might have been another gunman. That would seem like something you kind of want to look into, but...
Well, see, I was born in 1963, Jim.
Right.
So I was about 10 months old when John Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
For people older than me, It was, you know, not necessarily the end of World War II or the dropping of the atomic bomb, but the assassination of John Kennedy was the defining moment in this country from which I think you can make a compelling argument we have never recovered.
Oh, well, it totally changed the course of the, Kennedy, I have no doubt, was going to get us out of Vietnam by 65. You know, he had to wait till the... Because he already saw that Vietnam and already learned to not trust the CIA or pretty much the military, military industrial complex. I mean, they screwed him over with Cuba. And basically Cuba was already planned when Ike was president. You know, and I, from what I understand, that the way government works, can't just change things kind of like that. And then also a lot of things are going on you don't know anything about. Then it just happens.
And everybody looks up and says, what? Right.
Yeah.
And they're, but from that moment forward, Jim, this becomes a different America. There are so many of those little moments. The second one of those is the selection of George W. Bush for the presidency in late 2000. But from November 1963 forward, there's no Nixon president. Just to ponder that alternate reality, there's no Nixon presidency in 1968. I seriously doubt there would have been a Nixon candidacy. There is, I don't think there's a Vietnam. There's no Watergate, no Gerald Ford, no Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yeah, probably healthcare, real healthcare.
Well, and see, that's the thing. Medicare, and I always like to remind people of this, Medicare came in with the notion that 65 would be the age eligibility limit. It would Medicare 65. But the thought was, you know, in a couple of years, we'll, the Congress and the president will work together and we'll get it down to 60. In a couple more years, we'll get it down to 55. And a couple more years, we'll get it down to 50. And then pretty soon, it's just going to be universal single-payer health care like they were already, you know, because the United States was sitting very, very interestedly watching what was going on in Europe with the rise of the social health care system, the NIH, or the NHS, rather, the NHS in Great Britain, what was happening in France, what was happening in Germany as Germany rebuilt out of the, or at least West Germany rebuilt out of the ashes of the Second World War. And one of the first things everybody agreed was we've got to have universal single-payer health care.
Right.
And in fact, there was a debate, and very few people ever talk about this, there was a debate over health care that ran during the entire 8 years of Eisenhower's administration, and he was the one who put his foot down and stopped it time after time after time. And that's where we get the phrase socialized medicine, because the idea of bringing health care availability to every American citizen was equated by the weirdo reactionary right wing of this country with the demise of this country into some sort of dictatorship of the proletariat.
Yeah, well, it's just... It's sad. I mean,
Well, you must have had conversation after conversation after conversation with your father.
Wow.
I had no idea, Jim, and I thank you for sharing that with us. I mean, everything about the program just kind of went, you know, the brakes went. I'm stopped in my tracks.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that. Well, see, like another thing, I remember the day Kennedy was shot. I mean, I was only four, but I remember because the lady who was my babysitter, my sister's babysitter, housekeeper Maddie, I asked her, Maddie, why are you mad? Now, this is just one of those memories you have. And she's in my mother's parents' room, and they get up to bed, and somebody killed the president. Now, there's only one reason she would tell a four-year-old that. That must have been the day that happened, you know. So, I mean, that I have that memory. But, so it's just the thing that kind of blows my mind trying to advance to where we are is just how easily duped the people are. I mean, and I kind of did get duped with Obama, but you know.
No, you didn't. I mean, I can't crawl in your skull and wander around, Jim. But I would say no, you didn't.
Well, I could have voted Green Party, basically.
Which would have been, I mean, yeah, it's a vanity vote, and maybe your conscience somehow feels better, but then again, maybe it doesn't, because maybe you wind up with President McCain, and well. See, that nightmare scenario that still, Jim, plays over in my mind time and again of some stentorian-voiced announcer from one of the news networks. This is a special report. The death of a president. We take you now to the White House, where President McCain has finally succumbed to the cancers that ate him alive. President Palin is being sworn in. And you know, not okay.
Yeah.
So no. I voted for Obama twice. I did so with my eyes wide open from the moment he began running, and people began, oh, here's a liberal. And of course, every time a human being gets near the nomination, the Democratic nomination for president, as surely as you can time the eruptions of Old Faithful up at Yellowstone, there will be some right-winger who will say, oh, that's the most liberal man since Teddy Kennedy. And they said that about Barack Obama. And I'm sitting there going, who the, are they watching? Because I'm looking at a centrist who's coming out of the University of Chicago.
Right.
Okay? The University of Chicago, to the best of my knowledge, has never produced a liberal.
Right.
Granted, right. His undergrad work was Columbia, and his law degree was Harvard, but you don't get a job at the University of Chicago being some wild-eyed liberal with your hair on fire.
You don't get denominated to the D, with the DNC, or the Democratic Party. They're not going to let you get near that if you don't meet certain criteria.
And so, I mean, I think back, because I had a tangential involvement in everything, but, you know, I think back to the sleazing of Dennis Kucinich. You know,
oh.
Did you, Congressman Kucinich, did you really see a UFO?
I wanted to vote for him when I was living in Vegas. I was going to vote for him in the caucus just as a protest vote, but I didn't get a chance to, because right away it was, there weren't enough votes to count because you needed 10%.
I mean, I remember when some smart ass in one of the pageants said, Congressman Kucinich, are you electable? And he said, I'm electable if people vote for me.
Yeah, that's all it takes.
But nobody, and this is the thesis, nobody is ever going to get near the nomination. I mean, we can say the same thing for the Republican Party. There will never be, it's probably too much to say there'll never be another Abraham Lincoln. There just won't be another Abraham Lincoln. There'll never be another Teddy Roosevelt in the Republican Party. Herbert Hoover is vilified because of the Depression, but the man was effective in other ways. There won't even be another Herbert Hoover. There won't be another Dwight Eisenhower in the Republican Party. And by the same token, there will not be another FDR in the Democratic Party. There won't be another John Kennedy. Okay, there won't be another Jimmy Carter. What we will have now and into the future is a steady stream, as far as the eye can see or the mind imagine, of center right imperial administrators. Because that's what the presidency is now.
That's what I brought about Gorby to one of his book of essays was basically about empire, you know.
Yeah.
And he was writing about that in the 80s. Yeah, I mean, he saw it in the 80s. I mean, in hindsight, I can see it.
And see, all those people, the leaders of the opposition in other countries over the course of the last few generations who referred to American imperialism, and that phrase was somehow, they went over the top, you know, running dogs of American imperialism, that kind of. Just couldn't resist the metaphor. But American imperialism is a very real thing.
Look at Afghanistan. Look at Iraq. Look at the...
Yeah, see, a country that's not an empire doesn't go to Iraq. A country that's not an empire doesn't go to Afghanistan. Hell, a country that's not an empire doesn't go to Grenada. Or Panama.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
It always does us so much good. Oh, there's the military... defense, military-industrial complex, well. But the weird thing about that is this ties into the coal by virtue of the oil that it takes to get all the troops and everything over there. You have to transport it. You have to burn all that oil. And then, that goes in the sky and it doesn't just disappear. Jesus doesn't come with his little fairies and take it away in little thimbles and make it all better, hence the climate change, yeah.
No. I've got a story here that's been sitting here for a couple of days just sets my hair on fire. Just language that when you read it the first time, you kind of get the shudders. I mean, just check out this headline, and it's based on science. Greenland and Antarctica may be vulnerable to rapid ice loss through catastrophic disintegration. When's the last time you heard about a continent suffering catastrophic disintegration, Jim?
Yeah. Well, it's just like Colbert show a couple of nights ago. And they do it in a funny way, but it's serious. They're talking about... And disappearing, you know? I mean, and in a way, that's the only way you can kind of get that real news out there, you know? You know, and then what was it, the oil executive a couple months, a year ago, saying, well, we'll just have to adapt to it, you know, about the climate change, kind of admitted it. The executive of, I don't know, Exxon, whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it was Shell, and he said, we'll just move to where the climate change is not wrecking the planet. This guy apparently knows nothing whatsoever about catastrophic mass migrations?
Well, doesn't realize that there have been, four or five mass extinctions, and that maybe we really aren't that special in the grand scheme of things. And if we don't take care of this planet, I don't think the sky spook's going to do it, you know? So.
No, I don't know. I don't care how many times I think, yeah, but we got dominion. No. See, if you've got dominion over the earth, giant sinkholes don't open up in Florida and suck up, or Louisiana and suck up entire neighborhoods. It doesn't happen that way.
Yeah. Well, we got hurricane season coming up. Well, we're right in the middle of it. Well, not quite, but it's coming up.
Yeah, nothing's really played around with your corner of the Gulf yet, but you are far from out of the woods.
Oh, well, down since the new expanded long-term hurricane season, you know, going to November or what
yeah.
Hurricane went up to New Jersey, and then the thing about that hurricane, which from what I heard, maybe some left-wing conspiratorial weatherman that planted in my head, but instead of what a hurricane would do that late in the season going that way would spin out and go out to the Atlantic, but because the water temperatures had changed, it ended up taking the left and hitting New Jersey, mostly in New York.
Yeah, or it just gets flat sucked into the Gulf. And the thing about a hurricane in the Gulf is the damn thing starts behaving like a pinball. And Florida's a bumper, and the rest of the Gulf Coast is, too.
Yeah, I've noticed, too, that the hurricanes are a lot bigger and stronger. It's, you know.
Well, I tell you this much, and this is my moment of shallowness for our conversation. You know, it's the 1st of August, so that means that I begin drumming my fingers on the table and awaiting college football season, which I realize marks me as an absolute Philistine. But
sorry, my dad was a big football fan.
Well, I was going to say, I have never had a better college football experience than the time that I got to go to Baton Rouge and get harangued by the Tigers fans as we walked into the, you know, all of them yelling, "Tiger bait, Tiger bait." Yeah, it was, you know, it's the only stadium I've ever been to where you can get yourself a Gator and Dewey sausage dog in the stands.
Yeah, well, I was in New Orleans the other day. I had an alligator hot dog. It was pretty good.
Damn good, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I'm sure at some, maybe you have, maybe you haven't, what is it, swamp people or whatever, about the people who hunt gators down there in the bayous?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm proud to announce that West Virginia's got its own reality show premiering tonight on A&E that isn't Buck Wild. And I actually know somebody who's involved with this. There is a reality show coming, and it starts tonight on A&E, called Hatfields and McCoys White Lightning. I kid you not. You know, these they're becoming more and more contrived, these setups for reality shows. And in this one, an entrepreneur is coming into the area where the Hatfields and McCoys feud was, and they've gathered up a bunch of Hatfields and a bunch of McCoys, and they're all going to make moonshine together and make $1 million.
Oh, yeah.
And well, much hilarity ensues. Oh, my God.
All those shows, and even some I kind of like the one that there's the porn stars out of Vegas.
You know what? That's surprisingly engaging to watch because there's a lot of artifacts involved. And yeah, Pawn Stars doesn't bother me. The one that really drove me a little bit nuts, Jim, was the one that was running on the Weather Channel, and I only caught a couple of episodes, and it really didn't take much more than that, of the people who take boats to icebergs and shoot at icebergs to get hunks of iceberg on their boat to take it back to port and melt it and bottle it for bottled water. I'm not kidding. You know, about 200 yards out from the iceberg, and their little boat bobbing somewhere in the North Atlantic, and they got a 30-06, and they're shooting at icebergs. I mean, I couldn't even work up a good, you know, you got to lead them a little bit joke for that.
Yeah, it's but also the weird thing about those shows is, and maybe it's just my conspiratorial mind, it's kind of like conditioning people. Well, sure, times are tough, but maybe you can make money off of shooting icebergs. Or maybe you can make money out of opening your own little pawn shop or this or that. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It also represents was it Bruce Springsteen that had that song years ago, 150 channels or 160 channels or 74 channels or what, and nothing on?
Somebody, yeah.
And so... What we're also seeing is the absolute, I don't know, what do you call it? The expansion of this kind of media to try to make sure that they find something for everybody to be watching so that everybody will keep their heads down and just live happily in the empire.
Yeah, in a way, I wouldn't mind if they just kind of spread the wealth around a little bit more. I don't think the billionaires need as much as they have. You know, they just kind of...
Well, heck, can you imagine, I mean, you know, with Ferg and Margie and Doodle and my grown-up children and our grandchildren and Agnes and me, what a reality show this would be. Except it really is reality. Whereas that stuff is largely staged.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the whole thing, but even when you think about it, you think, just to shoot one of those, you're not just going to film for 8 hours and then have nothing happen. So you got to, like, stage some of it. So I've kind of gotten over my infatuation with the quote-unquote reality show. I prefer reality radio like you do. So.
Well, I thank you very kindly, Jim. And thanks for sharing that piece of family history with us. I really do appreciate it.
What do you got? Well, I just felt like I, very proud of my father and what he did. And
you should be.
Sharing it. So
you very much should be. Well, thank you, Jim, and you have yourself a good evening.
All right. Check you later.
All right. Take her easy. Bye now. Jim, and a little bit of firsthand history there. I'm guessing that hasn't happened anywhere on the for-profit media today. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, I got to give you some firsthand history that ties right into the last conversation.
Okay. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Great. I attended a party. I may have mentioned this on your show, where a relative on my mother's side had a lot of attorneys and educated people, which is why my father married into that family. And when I applied for my secret clearance to guard U.S. embassies in 1977, one of the men at the party, who my father really was never impressed with by reputation or personal knowledge, which was not much, but it didn't take much. He criticized him for just being an Army soldier and gotten an FBI position. His name was FBI agent O'Shea was his last name. And so, Shay, I was about 6 years old. I can remember specifically the brand new neighborhood being built. We were in the trailer of a construction trailer on this site out on the outskirts of Springfield where I grew up. His name was William O'Shea, and he didn't pay any attention to me. And as a kid, I was smart enough to know he didn't acknowledge kids. You weren't either. You had no finesse, no caress, no panache, no humanity in yourself. You were so encaptured with yourself. The last caller's father had a lot of foresight. The garrisons, and I obviously I couldn't do a three-way call, but I guess the people that followed the Garrison family were Harry Connick Sr.'s father, was the district attorney after Harrison, who's also a fellow compassionate human being. But Williams O'Shea at that party, surrounded by my father's friends that he grew up with, that all became public school teachers, they'd all graduated college, and they were men that had just a little more together and opportunity. So my father had married into this family, the Dirksen family. They have a building in Washington, D.C.
I was in just last week.
And my mother's a Dirksen from Illinois, and my dad was a good-looking white guy from Illinois, and my mom was a good-looking blonde-haired lady, and she pulled him literally right out of the project. So we're at this party, and I'm 55, so I was listening to your call, Bob, with this guy, and, you know, you were at your age, and then that guy was at his age. I had a whole year on you guys, so let me share my wisdom with you, right?
Oh, sure.
Right, I've got a full year on y'all, but the thing that I noticed at that party was three or four guys were standing around listening to him kind of talk. He wasn't a big guy. My dad wasn't a big guy. I'm a big guy. And he wasn't really mesmerizing people with his bullshit. They really were just being polite. And I was a really well-behaved kid. Our family was so poor that, in a way, poor in a Yankee Midwest emerging economy way, that you were brought up quickly to be responsible. And then if you could act like an adult, we'll bring you along. And that's kind of what it was. And so a lot of kids that had, you know, the families had the wherewithal would be home with a relative or babysitter, obviously. But I was an adult at a very young age, and in many ways, physically, mentally. And I kind of slid in behind my old man, and so Shay says, well, let me show you my gun. And this is at the end of the conversation. He gets his pistol out. I don't really recall if it came from his waistband, I think, maybe his ankle, but I think it was the waist area. It was a pistol. It's a .38. Of course, you know, at that age, I'd already seen, you know, a lot of Ponderosa and, you know, combat, and it's just a .38, and it could kill you. It was a pistol. And then afterwards, I'm riding home with my dad, my mom, and my sister. My dad says, well, you know, that wasn't his first observation. The guy's a real jerk, though, isn't he? And then he had to get his stupid gun out, you know, and show everybody, you know, how embarrassing is that, you know, to be, you know. And of course, we use,
man, that's just another night of socializing in West Virginia, Mark. Well, see my gun. I'll show you my gun. Here, let me see your gun.
Well, you know, and when it's in the 60s, and I didn't share with you that the guy showing his gun was bragging about doing surveillance on Martin Luther King's hotel rooms and making racial comments, and how he had been in actual hotel rooms right next to Martin Luther King, and he was home back in Illinois bragging about it, and that's my fault for not sharing that. And it ties right into the Bobby Kennedy tracking his brother's murder and Garrison's connection into our future. They really, you know, it's taken me all these years. I went running into the Marine Corps. Yeah, he bragged about doing surveillance on Martin Luther King, and he said some really racial comments, and that's what set my dad off on the way home. My dad didn't appreciate his racism and his language, and then he put him down because he was only in the Army. There was something about being a Marine that just, it wasn't because you were so well brainwashed. It was about a deeper conviction to brotherhood, regardless if you were, you know, whatever. So it was a deeper, you know, a lot of people don't realize when you're a Marine, you are AI. You have the responsibility very early as a Marine to maybe take over a company of Marines. In the Army, you've got 10 officers waiting to take over, and they're even fighting with each other. In the Marine Corps, you've got one officer, and he gets whacked, and a sergeant steps up. And so they put that pressure on you. And so when the Marines, for the gentleman from Ohio, and I don't...
Yeah, Bill.
Bill, and I love his voice, and I love his stories, but, you know, real grunts really hated Douglas MacArthur, and real grunts really hated Chesty Puller, and Chesty Puller was a kook, and Douglas MacArthur was an extreme person, really wrapped in his personality.
Well, I think you could probably say that that Douglas MacArthur had a really, really nasty fascist streak running through him. That's probably why he wound up in the Pacific Theater and not in Europe. He'd make too many friends.
Yeah, well, at that time, I guess you'd be obviously correct. He may be drug into the side that we're financing through Fritz Thyssen and Brown Brothers Harriman, and he might end up interrupting the Prescott-Bush connection to financing Adolf Hitler's rise to power. You know, we're smuggling machine guns to the Germans in the late 30s, mid-30s, after our World War One is over. You know, the buck stops here, going after corporate corruption at the time with Harry Truman, being an accountant, really, after being a war hero in World War One, gets a job at the Department of Defense, or the War Department, excuse me, the DOD now, and, so MacArthur has 9 artillery duels with the Germans and wins every one and loses no Americans, just a couple casualties. A brave little son of a bitch, you know, and he had integrity, and that's something about Smedley Butler. When they go through Marine Corps boot camp, they just gloss over. They talk about Dan Daly and Smedley Butler and these people, Vera Cruz and Chapultepec and the Blood Stripe, and it's just a quick. I mean, they only spend just a few minutes or an hour in Marine Corps history, and you just know that you got to, you know, this is what you're upholding, gentlemen. And so you move on, and you literally, you know, stand up from your seats en masse at attention, and move on to the next subject. But you're immediately, because you're there, you're a part of this contemporary history. And, you know, when I went in, it was kind of like I knew the country was kind of falling apart in my mind. I saw Watergate. I watched it as a kid in high school. I was very dubious of it. I had friends that were, very suspicious of it. I love Robert Redford's 3 Days of the Condor. It was very judicious, and it talks about oil, getting back to Garrison's phone call, and New Orleans and oil, and Central America and Arbenz and Guatemala and oil, and then Vietnam and oil, and Standard Oil in the 1920s, and
Iran and oil, and
Iran and oil and natural
Mossadegh
gas.
Mossadegh and the coup, you know, of the royal house of Ibn Saud in Arabia, because we wanted to set up Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company.
I think a lot of Americans like Eisenhower as a human being, but a lot of things seem he was Reagan-esque in that regard, because he was very popular. He was kind of letting his emotional guard down after winning World War II, and participating. And I think a lot of Americans respected him. And at that point, the Republican Party was not so self-destructive to a nation. They were, people that were to some degree kind of a patriotic group that knew not to mess with labor because we Democrats were labor, and there was a collateral respect, and even Eisenhower knew that. But the thing about Eisenhower, you have Arbenz in Guatemala, and you have the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, which we are still feeling the repercussions of. I haven't called your show because I'm working for the Koch brothers, unfortunately, to say.
No, don't let that slow you down. I mean,
first day I got on the bus, there's thousands of people on this job. It's a 100% union job. I won't say what state it's in, but it's in the upper Midwest. I got online, and what little I've learned about this project and a lot of the product that we're pumping out of here, with my support and everybody else's support, more theirs than mine, but it's going to mountaintop removal countries like India and China. So, the emerging economy for those types of products that this place kicks out.
Yep.
And, thank goodness I've, listened and learned more fine-tunedly to what's been educated of, maybe because I have the same open heart and non-judicious judgmentalism of other people that allow me to, and for you, I'm like, when you're able to discuss religion, I don't know really anything about it on that note, because
lucky you.
Well, and lucky, in a way, anyway, your metamorphosis, or even if it's to be considered that, Bob, is really says a lot about, you know, your own person, and you keep it, you come to very similar exact same conclusions that I seem to come to. I'm grateful for inconsequential good things that happen to me. I don't know who to give thanks to, but, you know, when John F. Kennedy was killed, they changed the world. And then Martin Luther King spoke out against Vietnam. And we have a lot of things that we need to be concerned with here in our own nation. And what did those people there do to us as a... They're not attacking us. And Iraq didn't attack us. And Honduras didn't attack us. And Guatemala didn't attack us. And Iran can't attack us. And China wouldn't be able to attack us if Henry Kissinger wouldn't have given the miniature nuclear warheads put on the end of their space program, which we went over there and set up. It's like Douglas MacArthur's jackass going to the Philippines. Well, why were the Americans even in the Philippines? Well, that's where we got the goddamn coal to run our ships before we had oil to run them after, before.
Had to have some coaling stations.
We had to have some coaling stations then, and that coal, but it got some nice shoes for people. So,
let me just interject something here for a moment. You mentioned labor history. I won't ask you to do me a favor in this regard, but I will suggest that you will be glad that you did. Go and download the last 3 days of Dr. Bill O'Brien's show, Mark.
Could you give me the dates, Bobby?
Well, it's the 1st, the 31st, and the 30th.
Okay.
July 30th, July 31st, and I'm sorry, July 29th, 30th, and 31st.
Okay.
And because I think the discussion that Dr. Bill has led over the past 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, will prove a gigantic eye-opener for you, especially the way he closed yesterday's program. And it's kind of like watching, Ferg and I last night, I'm trying to expand his film horizons a little bit. So last night I got him to sit down and watch with me the 1957 classic with Charles Laughton and Marlena Dietrich and Tyrone Power, and a very young Ruta Lee, called Witness for the Prosecution. And he absolutely enjoyed it. But I looked at him, and I said, now, this is not like a modern movie where you can wander around, go get a snack. I said, if you turn away for a second, you're going to miss everything, and nothing's going to make sense at the end. And so what Dr. Bill has done on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday is exactly that. You take it all in, and then, honest to God, in the last 3 minutes of yesterday's Dr. Bill's Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, he poleaxed me, and me. I mean, I saw stars, and I think the same thing will happen for you and anybody else who listens to it.
I'm sure it will. Yeah.
So I just highly suggest that you take that in. The other thing I have to share with you, Mark, because you've brought up some of these issues, I was directed to a website today that I had never seen before called Mint Press News, mintpressnews.com. And it is it's an expose in two parts of how a corporate Intel/communications firm that is now called Strat4 has gone about completely demolishing all of the justice movements in the United States. And if you just go to mintpressnews.com and look up Strat4, Stratfor, I imagine it'll pop right for you. It is absolutely amazing. For instance, there's a line here where, and these are Vietnam military guys, okay, who were strategizing, and they took it to corporate America, and it's basically old COINTELPRO stuff being translated to the modern age. For instance, Bart Mongoven, M-O-N-G-O-V-E-N, is one of the partners in this outfit. And speaking of Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, he said in emails that were released via the global intelligence files of WikiLeaks, in an email exchange, Mongevin wrote, "I'm in favor of using whatever trumped-up charge is available to get Assange and his servers off the streets. And I'd feed that shithead soldier Bradley Manning to the first pack of wild dogs I could find, or perhaps just do to him whatever the Iranians are doing to our sources there." So, if there's ever been any doubt that corporate America is at openly at war with those of us who seek social and economic justice, and the reason I bring this up is because that same strain of assholery, Mark, that attended that jerk who bragged about surveilling Dr. King.
Correct.
Well, these are his philosophical children.
Kind of the 21st century internet assassin.
And one of the things that comes out of this is that these people are so far ahead of the social justice movement that we can't even see them. And as a consequence, they whip our ass at every turn. And the whole principle of divide and conquer is alive and well. This thing talks about, for instance, how they've determined that all social activists may be categorized as one of four subsets. And those four subsets are the pragmatist. I got to find it here. Yeah, and they wage information warfare is basically what it is.
I understand.
They say that all activists may be categorized as radicals, idealists, realists, and opportunists.
Well, I would call us humans.
Well, there's that. Yeah, see, they don't see us as that.
Well, that's fine, and that's, you know, it's a gift, even though it's very difficult to complete. It's a gift, having gone through Marine Corps brainwashing. I was a smart kid that had a very judicious father that was very suspicious of his own experiences before, during, and after the Marine Corps. He was never brainwashed by the Marine Corps himself, knew that he found himself in that Marine Corps on his way to the Korean War, not to go get furniture for officers, like so many people's Korean experiences. That he prepared me psychologically and physically, Bob, with so much mental and physical discipline as a kid that I could handle their brainwashing, because my mental and physical connections were so connected that, in other words, I'm not saying that you couldn't torture me and get me to say something that I didn't agree with, but that I would always have probably, like yourself, knowing you through the phone, a very suspicious, you know, judicious, you know, we might say something that's not what you really mean, but you're saying that to survive, like we all do. And one of the things that boot camp does to people, that, and I'm not being critical of other branches of the service, and my humanity of my heart and soul, I can interpret it, but that when they don't brainwash you well enough, you don't lose touch with your humanity, so you're more likely to kill yourself. And that the death rates from suicides from Marines from Vietnam and probably right now are less than other branches, even though they conduct maybe more horrific things or equally inappropriate things. But they're very more controlled, organized group. But the point is that brainwashing that they do allows me to see how they remove, you know, Ho Chi Minh, you son of a bitch, is what they're telling you. When you're marching, you've been running for, you know, 17 miles or 7 miles or 3 miles, or, you know, you're very fatigued, and you're like, well, Ho Chi Minh's a son of a bitch. We've been out of there for 2 years. I mean, so why is he a son of a bitch? Well, because we didn't have a son of a bitch at that time, but I was bright enough to go, well, that didn't make any sense. But I knew that Dan Bailey had gotten a couple of Medal of Honors, but you know, until I protested the war in Iraq, like yourself, I associated myself with Veterans for Peace, and I found out that the guys that created Veterans for Peace were the soldiers that came home during the, you know, the Westmoreland. You know, they killed John Kennedy, and they go to Vietnam, and 60,000 Americans died. If you question that, you're not a patriot. Well, that's all the same shit that they've done now. Same with these jackasses you're mentioning that Men Press has shown the removal and the expulsion of the human nature on a side note, the exact same thing. Most of the fraggings done in Vietnam were done by sons of blue collar, probably union workers in Vietnam. No, I'm not taking that fucking hill. And if your ass isn't going up there, and you're telling us to go there at 3 o'clock in the morning, well, when you go to seat 01, you better put some Teflon on the front of that tent or down in that pit.
Well, I will never forget I was too young to know it at the time, but what Muhammad Ali said in refusing to participate in the draft. Ain't no Viet Cong ever called me that word.
Correct.
Yeah. I found this fascinating. I got this, and you know, you're kind of our military affairs correspondent, whether you realize it or not, Mark.
Yeah.
But I found this absolutely fascinating. I got a press release today from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. They have done a joint study by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and the Williams Institute. And this study indicates, and this is mind-blowing, 20% of transgender people, and we're not talking about gay, we're not talking about lesbians, we're talking about transgender people, people who don't fit nicely into those gender stereotypes, like the big story that came out, a month, 2 months ago, of the a member of SEAL team that, you know...
Oh, yeah, right.
And is now a transitioning transgender person who is going from male to female and had to... you want to talk about tough? My God.
That's a brave person.
So it turns out that 20% of the transgender population have served in the military. Now, here's the shocker. That's double the percentage of the U.S. general population that has served in the United States military.
Well, you know, you can go back to the what's the little guy's name that killed a lot of Germans, and Audie Murphy. People, because of the pressure that we have in our own country and racism and sexism and this male-dominant society, that people that have a desire to go a certain direction in life, that know they have to go through this metamorphosis, or so they have to show this personal, physical courage and challenge to say that I am a righteous person, though I may not think the same way another person, or the general impression of the propaganda of the, you know, I was listening to your show a few weeks ago. You know, where families are really never have been, the cleavers. That's what they commercialize. So in other words, it's my impression that, Audie Murphy may not have been a big man, and courage can come in any gender or any transgender. It can come in any, it's just hatred. It's just racism.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just hate. And these poor people, including myself, you have to be, they never made me hateful. The Marine Corps never made me hateful. And, they try through, it's the male locker room, racism. Marines, I only know the Marines pretty well, but they're pretty professional, but there's that, They are pretty professional, because they really blend in. They did at one time right into federal government service, and they seem, for the most part, it's like the guy that tried to save Trayvon. He'd been in the Marine Corps 9 years. And he jumped out of the ground trying to save the kid, mouth to mouth. And, the fat ass didn't do nothing. He was glad he shot him. He was worried about his
And now... good shooting Zim. I'll never forget that internet moment. is wandering around Texas and apparently got pulled over somewhere in Texas today with a weapon concealed in his glove box.
Huxley, Texas. Where is it? And the cop asked him, where are you going? He said, I really didn't know where I was going or something. So he's running fast. You know, I said to my buddy on the job, I won't say what state I'm in, but I'm in a north midwestern state where the people have a decent degree of education, and both of their senators are Democrats. And my friend that I'm working with, squared away guy, he finds out where I'm from, and he asked me, and I told him that I live about an hour and a half from where I was from, and he said a couple comments, and then he made a comment. He says it looks like the guy's on the run. He's trying to get away, you know, in his mind. But he was trying to be white, and he thought if he killed this black kid, then all the cops that he associated himself with, a retired army jackass that could recognize screaming to, because he'd been a corpsman, as we say in the Marine Corps, or a medic in the army in Vietnam, and he's heard men scream, and I can recognize men's screams, but other people that hadn't heard men scream can't recognize a man scream, because I spent 360.
Isn't that fascinating how Trayvon Martin immediately got demanded? You know, Zimmerman was the man, not, yeah.
He's still the man. And how can you get pulled over in a small town, or, well, by a small, actually, I think it would be kind of interesting to see. I think there would be an indicator to me, based on my life experiences. He was pulled over by a small agency. Now, were they up on the highway, like you could get hit by some small highway, big highway, but small departments in South Georgia. Now, you know, you think it would be the Georgia Highway Patrol pulling you over, but you're like, what? Who's this? But for some reason, they have the authority to shoot out there and enforce the tickets, which is their prerogative. But my point is, to be speeding in Texas, and probably some kind of, he was in a pickup truck, I mean, you have to be doing something kind of really auspicious to get pulled over. And he's chubby and kind of white, so he should have blended in. By if the cop got to see his face, who knows?
I wonder if there were Florida plates on the car. Those would probably stand out a little bit in a place like Texas. But.
That's correct. But you know, the Florida tag, similar to the Texas tag, has a white background. The difference would be the black lettering versus the dark green, the letter
yeah.
the green. Or,
yeah.
Right,
so. Well, by the way, I have a question here for you coming in from Jack in Shreveport, Mark. He says, I'm wondering if the psychological boot camp training used in the military hasn't been used in the militarization of the police. That would make things as if the police, especially as they work as partners, would be fighting to keep their buddies alive and that they were at war with everyone else, which would be all other American citizens.
Well,
and I read a fascinating article the other day on the militarization of the police, and it was harrowing.
It wasn't David Goff?
Actually, it came out of the Wall Street Journal. It was one of the few pieces of journalism I've seen happen there, and it was in depth, it was broad, it was detail rich, and I just knocked me for a loop.
Well, I would say after having attended and graduating from an academy and having been handed a leadership role in academy, our academy class, Bob and Dave County, in the early 80s was so large that it had a number of platoons in it, and I was given a platoon, and actually our platoon leader, to address the gentleman's question from Louisiana, my platoon leader had been a tanker in Vietnam, so they're very paramilitaristic, militaristic, and because cops really don't know which direction to go as people, and they're in uniform, so they go to where people that have been in uniforms are, so they're very easily, and it's unfortunate because even you know, after having worn a Marine uniform and then jumped into a police uniform, you can tell, and it's, you know, it's kind of sick and sadistic, but you can tell a guy that's not as regimented as yourself that he doesn't have the capability to, you know, to fill out forms or do time or to address things in a tactical fashion. So there's a peer pressure that's put on people. So yes, there is a culture, and it's not gone away. Stan Goff, I think, is my friend that I've read. He's a big anti-Iraq person who liked David Hackworth about, you know, about faith author, the gentleman that wrote for Newsweek quite often. He talked about the militarization of law enforcement and the policification of the army, and he'd been a special forces person in the U.S. Army, a prior ranger, and he has quite the military credentials himself as a human being, a Vietnam veteran himself, and whose son is a veteran probably at this time, but was serving. But he talks much about it. I would love to have read that article. There's a part of me that wants to steer away from that many times, but the benefit is quite off. And the thing is, the streets, though crime in a certain way, just looking at the subject from a peripheral standpoint, crime in general has tended to be sliding sideways. Incarceration rates have been skyrocketing, but they're inconsequential. To me, as a former cop, you're usually economic related crimes, you know, and most people are not criminalistic in nature. You know, it's a very small percentage of people, and that is usually associated with psychological issues, which has also been privatized and corporatized and eliminated, it's not even been privatized. You know, the Health and Human Services of Florida is ran by J.P. Morgan.
It's been corporatized.
It's corporatized, and same with unemployment there is ran by J.P. Morgan. And actually, Enron's side of Azurix has a number of stainless buildings wrapped with high cyclone fences around North Central Florida that I had witnessed. If you're sharp enough to go up and look at the damn stainless labels that are tacked on there, those are Azurix things, and that was the agenda of Jeb Bush's son, was, you know, to continue to privatize water, which is, you know, Coca-Cola is privatized. You know,
Coca-Cola, Nestle. Who was the guy that was big in wind?
Not the dude from Oklahoma.
Yeah,
that's the oil guy.
Yeah,
he's into wind. Is that his pitch? He's the wind guy, but he's really the oil guy.
He's really the water guy.
Yeah.
That's
not the guy that gets all the money to the college there. The
Yeah. They named the Oklahoma State football stadium after him.
Oh, you know, there's a part of me, even though I'm a damn Yankee, there's a part of me that likes him as a man. You know, I like.
Yeah, T. Boone Pickens.
T. Boone, I like him.
Yeah, he got people all fired up over wind power a few years ago. Good on him. But by the same token, what was running underneath him was, or running in the background,
fracking.
Not just fracking, but an attempt to take control of clean water supplies. Because the fact of the matter is, and you know, we don't have to get the Reynolds wrap keeps everything wrapped up tight aluminum foil out and start wrapping it around our noggins to realize that, you know, the next great futures market manipulation frontier is in the basic essentials of life. One of the things that people sort of neglect, I've seen people say, oh, you know, it was the WikiLeaks is what sprung the Arab Spring. Well, not in Egypt it didn't. In Egypt, the fact that people could no longer afford literally their daily bread is what triggered the Arab Spring in Egypt. And the reason they could not afford their daily bread was because a few years back, and I can't cite chapter and verse, and I'm sorry.
You're not going to tell me what we're getting ready to hear.
A few years back, the big banks, you know, the big swappers, the Goldman Sachs and the J.P. Morgans and so forth, a regulation was lifted. There had, until that time, Mark, been a ban on speculating in the futures of essential staples of life, like wheat. That was lifted. The market speculation took off, and the next thing you know, you know, Mama and Daddy are listening to baby's belly rumble for want of a little bit of effing pita bread in Alexandria.
Privatization, corporatization, globalization caused Egypt. It really did. That's what those were the driving sources. And we, you know, for the jackasses, there was somebody on the Huffington Post. There was an article about some stupid congressman in Arizona saying, "Well,
when he was in the U.S. Army, his commanding officer or friend told him to always be prepared to maybe even have to take on his government. And these jackasses realizes when the shit hits the fan in this country, if you walk out in that fucking street with a rifle, that a fucking drone's going to take you out, that a goddamn helicopter's going to take you out. You ain't going to do shit. This country could go into breadlines as quick as Egypt, if not faster, or in a quicker transition. Our economy sits, I believe, in a very precarious nature.
Well, you know, it's interesting you would bring that up, Mark, because I'm looking at a story right now coming out of what was called a self-reliance rally held by a bunch of godforsaken teabaggers in Idaho. It was organized by that revolting outfit called Oath Keepers.
Oh, they're dangerous.
They're creepy. So Washington, now this guy's not a national rep, he's just a state representative. State representative out of the state of Washington named Matt Shea.
I think that's a jackass. The dude's got glasses, Bob?
No. This guy has like little beady blue eyes. The Coeur d'Alene Press says that Shea, who is the assistant Republican floor leader in the state of Washington, said, "We need to prepare for the inevitable collapse that is going to happen. You know it's going to happen. That's right. I am a politician, and I am standing up here and saying that. When it happens, we need to look at this as an opportunity, not a crisis. Whose job is liberty? That's our job." Okay? And so what they went on to advise is that people stockpile ammunition, practice shooting, learn defense tactics, and prepare for massive economic collapse. Now, this is just typical for these asshats. Among other things, last February he introduced a bill in the Washington State Legislature to ban the U.S. dollar.
He's trying to get out ahead of the curve and start buying the gold, huh?
Yeah. He's also one of these people that claims that FEMA operates concentration camps in the United States. And that one in particular, Mark, drives me just a little bit south of crazy, because we do operate a concentration camp.
Okay.
And it's in Cuba.
That's not the only one, but I would agree, Bob. Totally.
Yeah, I mean, we've got other sites elsewhere, but you know, that's the principal one. We are running a concentration camp, and nobody's rounding up the Matt Shays of the world.
Well, you know, I'd like to take that little jackass and see if he could handle being tube-fed like those guys down there.
Among other things, the Spokane Spokesman Review notes that he was cited twice for violations of Washington's firearms law when he, quote, pulled a gun during a confrontation with another motorist last November in what police reports describe as a road rage incident.
Well, then he is a reflection of their own propaganda. They live in a parallel universe, Bob. It's like you said on your show, where people like the jackass that went into the non-denominational church in Tennessee, or the near miss shooting in California. These people are living in those worlds where, in their psychologically justified minds, that they are like the guys shooting the abortion doctors. I mean, they feel threatened. They want you to feel their corporate controlled message is to feel fear. Which is why I believe Bush, you know, obviously used the yellow code, the green code, the orange code. You know, it's a way, remember, wrap your house in plastic and get to the mall. It's all about psycho, and they believe the propaganda, but my impression, I don't doubt it would be much different than your own, is if the wheels do come off, and I'm not saying that they cannot, but that if they do, the only thing that will get us through the next day will be politeness and judiciousness and waiting in line respectfully, because they'll be handing out water and food to people. And you show up with your rifle, even where I live in Central Florida, Bob, there's a guy on my street that apparently his father had died and given him this house. Now, he doesn't know because of my Marine Corps capabilities. I think he had been in the Army, but unbeknownst to him, even though I'm a couple years older than him, he would be the first person that I would target because what hangs in his garage, he leaves the garage door intentionally open, are the Don't Tread on Me and then a rifle. He's got some rifle flags that hangs in there, and I've seen the stickers on his truck. So to me, as a law-abiding, honest, earnest human being that cares about folks in a polite way, that would be my biggest threat, would be the George Zimmerman threat.
Well, see, what scares me to pieces, Mark, is that you've got these people who are stockpiling arms inside neighborhoods. I mean, there was a story out of, I can't remember where, about a guy who, his wife, he was late for work. The three-year-old was playing on the floor. His wife was on the way home from work and said she'd be there shortly. And so he claims that he pushed a sofa over in front of the bedroom door where all of his guns, including 15,000 rounds of ammunition and a grenade sitting on the desk, were, and left the three-year-old in the rest of the house and left. And he's got, you know, he's got a room full of firearms, 15,000 rounds of ammo, a loose grenade, and the guy's been taken in for perhaps reckless child endangerment. Okay, but no, these, you know, I joke sometimes, you know, they walk among us. They do.
Prevalent.
And what's prevalent. But what's frightening out of this is that should something bad begin to occur,
I'm listening.
The only thing that will save us is building community and understanding that we are all in this together. Can you imagine when rationing came out in the Second World War, Mark, if everybody had been like Ron Paul and said, every man for himself, screw the troops, I'm going to eat all the meat my belly will hold? Okay?
Well,
if the Second World War sacrifices at home had been asked of these modern teabaggers, it would have been a zombie apocalypse.
Exactly.
And the fact that they're eating, for one, I'm sorry, I just have to finish this up.
No. Totally
they
agree.
Scare me to death because, you know, if water's scarce, the only more people survive is if more people work together to make water less scarce. The people who are sitting there and you know, with their guns on the porch awaiting for the zombies, and, you know, here's the fun part, anybody who's not them is a zombie, and they start shooting each other. I mentioned the Hatfields and McCoys a little bit ago. That'll seem like a walk in the park. These people are planning on making matters worse because, for whatever pathological reason, they yearn, they long for chaos and destruction, because somehow or another they think they're going to be the fittest out of this and they are going to survive. When the entirety, as Dr. John has so often noted, the entirety of human history suggests that the only way we survive is when we band together and work together.
Totally agree. That's totally a principle in any subject, whether it's sports, and to include the military. One thing, that's totally a fact. And I don't even like their ad, Army of One. It's not a bootstraps pull myself up.
Yeah, I was always put off by that.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, why would I want? What the hell are you talking about, dude? Army of One.
I ain't taking the Iraq by myself. Right. Yeah. By the way, Mark, you got fan mail in from Kate. She says, thanks for mentioning Hack. He's a hero of mine. And she said, and welcome to the Northern State with two Democratic senators. Good to hear from you.
Well, I won't guess where Kate's from, but. David Hackworth was a good man, and I think he would. I think you and I would both. Anybody that after Vietnam, at age 15, he's in the hills of Italy. If the gentleman from Ohio wants to read about a real soldier, a soldier's soldier who earned his commission at age 15, was in the hills of Italy in World War II. At the age of 21, had gotten the commission in the army, served at least one combat tour in Korea. And then does at least three combat tours in Vietnam, learns how to defeat the Vietnamese and using their own tactics of hit and run, and studying the North Vietnamese guerrilla tactics successfully, presents a paper as an educated person, a guy that brought himself up to the chain of command and running Vietnam. Of course, they didn't want to read it. And then one of the things, you know, he said, "Well, just to hell with you, United States. I'm moving to Australia." And became a millionaire raising ducks somehow at a profitable in a profitable fashion. I remember when he came back to the States in the late 70s, and they talked about him. I said, "That's got to be a pretty cool dude." And it turns out David Hackworth is really a person of counterculture. Now, I don't believe he's counterculture. He is, a person that loved and cared about his country in a correct fashion. I would just say the murders of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy, and Medgar Evers, and many other people were done to give us Vietnam, and Vietnam has a direct oil connection. And then they broke this economy, they broke this will, they privatized our economy, they took the community out of the United States, and I will die fighting these people. And I would tell you this, Bob, and it won't surprise you, the Bush family is directly involved with the murder of John F. Kennedy, and so are the two jackasses that I'm working for right now. Indirectly, but they are directly connected, and it is fascism. And I'll hang up so somebody else can get in here. But I got on the bus because there's thousands of people rolling into this project. And I swear to God, I thought of you, Bob. I thought, I'm on this bus and these guys are older than me, salty big sons of bitches from up here. And they said, yeah, I guess they ask you to work overtime. And the one guy says, yeah, they asked me. And he goes, so the guy, I swear to God, this is what the dude said, Bob. They didn't know me from hell beans. I'm just another dude getting on the bus. They don't see that I'm new because they don't see my gear. I'm in civilian clothes like they are. And the dude says, well, you're gonna give the Koch brothers some more of your money? You're gonna help these fuckers out of the hole by going to work for them this weekend, working overtime for them? Or are you gonna be with us? That's what he basically said.
Man, watch out for that, Mark, because they plant that kind of stuff in there, though. But you know that better than I do. Hey, Mark, I got to roll because we're short time, but it's been awful good talking to you. Be well and stay safe.
I do, Bob, as well to you, brother, and I'm always your brother at No Arms.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bless you, Bobby.
See you, Mark. Mark calling from Parts Unknown. And it's time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for getting us a long way toward Out of the Hole. Our last contribution for the evening, at least during live showtime, coming in from Philip, who says, I'm contributing despite having exceeded my allotted donations. However, I do so under protest. The cot on a hot tin roof remark last night was spontaneous. These things just come to me, and I utter them to the horror and disdain of my friends. To borrow rudely from Shakespeare, they admonish me by saying, get thee to a punnery, and remind me that puns are the lowest form of humor, as if that would stop me. And there is more to the email that perhaps I can share tomorrow evening. But thank you, Philip, very much. That takes us up to $345 for the evening, and gets us within the $300 striking range of being done with July and off to a fighting chance for the month of August. So thank you very kindly. Thank you to everyone who contributes to keep all of this going. You are the only reason the horn is still here. Thank you. Thank you very kindly. Janie and Randy and Ed and Jude and Kate and Betsy and Jason and Philip, thank you. And if I missed anyone, I sincerely apologize. Thank you very kindly. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. Big news today. We had three new additions as co-sponsors to the AICACT. The work you do has meaning and effect. Thank you. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.